You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Sarah Williams Goldhagen. She is a contributing editor at Architectural Record and served as the architecture critic at The New Republic from 2005 to 2013. Her articles have appeared in The New York Times, American Prospect, Art in America. She's contributed essays to many publications, Assemblage, the Harvard Design Magazine, the Journal of the Society of Architectural Historians, and her new book we'll be discussing is Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. Sarah Williams Goldhagen, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you on. So I take the general idea behind this book to be that architecture and built environments in general are a much bigger factor and have a much greater impact on our lives, our mental health, our physical health, then we realize or pay attention to. Does that sum it up?
Yes, that does sum it up. And although there are certain aspects of that statement, that general statement that people have known and some people are more sensitive to than others, what's different now is that we have concrete evidence across a range of scientific studies showing just how profound the built environment and the environment in general, how profound an impact it is and what a profound role it plays in all sorts of ways that really almost no one could possibly imagine, as well as ways that they could. I mean, who knew that if you were placed to recover from surgery in a room that had a window to a brick wall, you would fare worse in terms of felt pain and healing than if you were across the hall in a room that had a view out to a pastoral landscape?
Well, to play devil's advocate a little bit, I would guess a number of people might have said they had a strong preference and thought they were doing better in the room with the view, but they might have been dismissed as being romantic and aesthetic and not having good evidence for their claim, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say that people would know that they preferred it. I can't think that they would imagine that they would heal 30% more quickly,
yeah,
by being in one place versus another. It's the degree to you know, people know, okay, you know, you walk into a cathedral, wow, it's soaring, it's cool, my spirits are uplifted. Sure, everybody knows that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What they don't know is how profound those effects are physiologically, psychologically, in terms of the way it shapes our behavior. And what they don't know is how profoundly negative poor built environments have an impact on us, because people tend to think they bifurcate the built environment into high architecture, like fancy buildings, museums, whatever, and then what everybody else gets to live in, unless you're Bill Gates. And what is clear now is that is a false dichotomy, because design actually has a really profound impact on mental health, decisions, behavior, quality of life, physical health, which means that everybody deserves to get good design.
With regard to high ceilings, you even suggest that people are more open to creative new concepts if they are in a room with higher ceilings when they hear about the concept. I mean, it sounds like a metaphor, but it's actually the case, right?
It is. I mean, what they did is they had people take tests of creativity in rooms with 8-foot ceilings or something like that, and then they brought people back and they put them in a room with very high ceilings, and they gave them different but similar tests, scoring similar things, tests on creativity, and they thought more creatively in the room with high ceilings. And that gets to an important point, which is which is the word you use, metaphor, which is that we use what are called schemas, which is basically patterns of association that we draw from living in our bodies in the world on Earth, experiencing gravity, having day follow night, and so on and so forth, that are drawn from our own experience of living as human beings on Earth. It's called embodied cognition. And many of those schemas are metaphorical. They're not literal. And so we have to expand out the kind of ways that we analyze what good design is and means beyond just the functional and the rational, because a lot of the things that have profound impact on us are things that you wouldn't necessarily expect. Like another study, a pretty famous one, they had they gave personnel, people in human resources departments, resumes, a stack of resumes to assess, and they handed them out on clipboards, whatever, and they said, assess these candidates. And it turned out that the people doing the assessing assessed candidates as having more intellectual gravitas and being better suited for the position when they were holding clipboards that were heavier.
When the candidates were, or when the assessors were?
When the assessors were holding clipboards on which they were looking at the resumes, the clipboards were heavier. Some clipboards were heavy and some were light.
So it sounds again like a metaphor. They interpreted the application as being weightier, the resume as
correct.
Being weightier. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And so we're constantly, when we're in our environments, I mean, that's an example of what psychologists call priming. We're being primed. It's almost like the whole subliminal seduction thing in the 1970s and 80s, you know, that they flash an image up and it would have an impact, you know, it would make you go and buy this liquor because you saw a naked woman there. Well, actually, some of that is really true. We're being primed by our built environments because that's where we live. Really all the time. So the question is, what are we priming people to, how are we priming them to act and to communicate with one another and so on and so forth. So there's the psychological component of this, and there's also the physiological component of this, which is what I started out talking about with, you know, healing from surgery and so on. And there's a lot of studies about that.
Yeah.
Regarding exposure to nature, exposure to natural light, exposure to different kinds of natural light, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you talk about light, color, form, sound, mm-hmm. and smell, and texture, temperatures, all these factors as actually impacting mental and physical and childhood development and intelligence
yep.
and life expectancy. I mean, that's... Give us some more examples and what we might be doing differently with this knowledge.
Well, child development is is a good example because it's one that tugs at people's hearts a lot and it's really important, right? I mean, everybody wants children to develop well. That's why we want better schools rather than worse schools for our children and so on and so forth. So there was a study in the UK done, which was sort of a long-term study of some 2,000, I think, students in 57 different classrooms, but the curriculum that they were being taught and the basic level of teaching ability of the teachers was the same, and it was also controlled for socioeconomic status.
Yeah.
And but these 57 classrooms were scored on 6 or 8 or whatever dimensions of design, including color, fostering creativity, flexibility, natural light, and so on and so forth. They followed students for 2 years, and by the end of 2 years, they found that the students in the best designed classroom were nearly a full year ahead academically from the students in the worst designed classroom.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And how were the designs different?
They fostered creativity. They were flexible, so you could rearrange seating for various different kinds of educational activities. They had much more natural light. They had access to the outdoors. I don't remember what the other one, the color, the use of color. You know, color is very complicated, but color, and it is to some extent culturally determined, but there we know physiologically that humans respond to certain colors in certain ways, and that's cross-cultural. And this is that's just one little piece of knowledge. It's kind of obvious that we should be paying attention to this and really using it. And I think that the reason that people haven't in the past, I mean, some people intuit it, but again, you know, it's sort of a discretion or doing, using these kinds of things has always been seen as discretionary.
Yeah.
Well, you can do it, but, you know, only if you can pay for it and all this kind of stuff. It's not discretionary. It's critical. It's central.
Sarah Goldhagen, your book is called Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives. You do take on this argument in the book, but what about the argument that boring boxes are just cheaper to make and that we're up against problems of concentration of wealth and population explosion that can't really be addressed by good design?
There's an easy answer to that, and it's sort of a quip. But and so I'll say it as a quip, and then I'll explain it. But the quip is, it's just as expensive to design a bad building as a good building. And the explanation, which is actually much more precise, is that at any level of investment, you can get a better design or a worse design. But you have to help people to understand that design is important in the first place. And you have to give them all the information that is, in fact, out there and is growing every day about what kinds of aspects of design really have an effect on people in order to help them figure out what they want to do. So right now, big boxes are cheaper, but, you know, you can do an awful lot with a big box design if you just hire someone who knows how to think these things through and who knows what the right priorities should be for the built environment, because buildings, you know, here I'm talking about buildings, but also landscapes. Once they're put in the ground, they're there for a really long time. They're not just there for the people who paid for them. They're not just there for the people who designed them. They're for everybody. People walk by them. They walk through them. They change ownership. They change functions.
Yeah.
And so this is really important. It's not just, you know, buying a nicer jacket versus buying a functional one.
It seems like it just...
And they go on for generations.
A lot of things are designed, right? I mean, it seems like the average normal-priced automobile is beautifully sculpted with curves and angles. And so, I mean, if you could blow it up to the size of the building, I'd like to live in most cars, right? But
I love that.
But somehow people buy... The people who buy cars need that to be willing to buy the car, but the people who buy buildings don't. They're happy with ugly buildings.
They're happy with ugly buildings because buildings are, if you think about the way that most people think of buildings or, you know, any kind of landscapes, because I talk about urban design and landscapes and buildings, all of them.
Sure.
Most people think of the environment that they inhabit as kind of stage sets, sort of neutral spaces, and what's important is what's going on that stage, which is your life. You're changing your kid's diaper, you're arguing with your wife, whatever, you know, you're writing the next great American novel, and so on, and that's what you're engaged in. You're not really, people aren't really focused on their environments very much, and we have to shift that. Instead of, take the metaphor of the stage set, instead of the stage set, what our built environments are our habitat. And they, just as an animal's habitat will profoundly shape how that animal does, how it fares, how it evolves, and so on, these are our habitats.
Yeah. The other hurdle that you take on in the book, or one of them, is that you describe people having a preference for the familiar that can mm-hmm. override a preference for what you say is demonstrably actually better and healthier and more enjoyable. How does
yep.
So people can become accustomed to an ugly habitat and develop a preference for it?
Sure. I mean, let's kind of a straightforward example is let's say you grew up in Levittown.
Yeah.
You know, where they're small. These are tiny houses. They're not very well designed. They're not very well put together. And they all look the same, right? But you grow up there. And so day after day, you had relations with your mother there, relations with your father, with your friends. You made friends. You went to school and so on and so forth. You know, those memories become very deeply embedded and are constitutive a part of who you are and who you identify yourself as being. And so when you think about what you want, people like things that are familiar. And this is one of the great contributions of the research that Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky did in behavioral economics. You know, they found that just the very fact that you own something or that it's familiar will skew you towards choosing it, even if that object, in the first case, is objectively worthless,
yeah.
or objectively, in the second case, not nearly as good as the alternative.
And so how do you break that cycle?
You give them better things to grow up in.
So forget the old people and save the children.
Well, you know, it's an interesting problem that, yes, save the children is basically my, that's part of my message. You know, as I was working on this book, I moved from a kind of very leafy, nice suburb outside of Boston, Newton, Massachusetts, to East Harlem, which has one of the highest concentrations of social housing anywhere in the country and is a very poor neighborhood. And, you know, I walk out of my front door every day and I see these deteriorating buildings, very poorly maintained, poorly built to begin with. And I think, you know, these people, these children are not getting nearly as good a shot in life just by occupying these environments.
The deck
is so stacked.
And your book might have been even better if you hadn't been living in that location, maybe.
No, I think it was improved, actually, because honestly, it started out as being really an investigation into what we now know about human perception and cognition and how that changes how our understanding of people's environments. And the more research I did and the more I looked around, the more I saw the social component as absolutely central to the argument.
Yeah. So let me ask a question as a non-scientist, Luddite, who knows very little about neuroscience.
Why should you?
Well, it seems to be central to the case here, to understanding the evidence, right? That a lot of our experience of the environment is not conscious, but we can go and examine brains in laboratories and discover that these aspects of our environment are having impacts on us. And I wonder how much that unaware impact really exists. I mean, it seems you give examples like Yale's art and architecture building. People non-consciously don't like it because they imagine touching its rough surface would be, you know, it would hurt to brush up against it. But that seems like a thought that could become conscious, especially after you've pointed it out to people. And like something it would be very hard to discover in a brain in a laboratory. It seems more like something you're actually aware of. And you give all these examples of architects who you tend to use the word intuited. They intuited that this material would have this effect prior to the existence of neuroscience. You know, so is it really things that we're unaware of, or things that some people are somewhat unaware of? What are we dealing with here?
Okay, these are great questions. Let me go through them one by one. The reason in the book I use the word, and I explain this, but I use the word non-conscious,
yeah,
is to differentiate it from unconscious. Unconscious means you can't get access to this. Like the fact that our heart is beating, we're not conscious of that. I mean, we can sort of become conscious of it, but that's a bad example. But let's take different examples. Basically, what we know about human consciousness now makes it pretty clear that consciousness is a spectrum. And by consciousness, I mean aware that you're aware of something, right?
Yeah.
And the human mind, the way that the mind is constructed, you can only hold one concrete, coherent thought or percept, they call it, in your mind at one time. But there's all this other stuff going on that is underneath, if you want to say it that way, underneath that one thought, the thought being, I got to go change the laundry and put it in the dryer, okay, or something, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
With all the other stuff, or with a lot of that other stuff that you're not really consciously thinking about, you could think about it. So it's just a matter of where you direct your attention and to the kind, what value you place on these things that are, you know, we're always under cognitive assault. There's so much sensory stimulation every minute we live.
Yeah.
And so it's not that that we cannot be conscious of these things. It's that most people aren't most of the time. And so if they focus on it, and they, you know, you might think, ugh, I don't like the AMA building at Yale by Paul Rudolph because it has this concrete aggregate that's very stony, and if you rub up against it, it's going to hurt you. You could think all of that, or you could just say, blech, what an ugly building,
yeah,
and move on, because that's what most people would do. They're not thinking about the building. They're thinking about their life. So that's part of the answer. The second part of the answer is, that it is why the use of cognitive neuroscience. Two things. One, I used a lot of cognitive neuroscience and I used a lot of environmental psychology. So it was two different fields that I was really, I looked at other fields as well, but those were two of the principal ones. And it's not really very relevant that they've located the place in the brain where we the neurons in the brain that we use for spatial navigation, which are called grid cells. I agree with you about that.
Yeah.
That's not that important. What is important about this information, particularly from cognitive neuroscience, is that it used to be that, okay, you mentioned two architects whose works I discuss. One is Alvarado, the other is Frank Lloyd Wright, I think. Yeah. And I say that they intuited things. So, up until now, throughout all of history, there were people who, of course, intuited that, you know, if you look at a surface texture, it actually makes you sort of feel like you want to touch it or not touch it, okay?
Yeah.
But that was one theory and one approach of doing design in the built environment among a whole slew of other theories and approaches. So I happen to mention in my book the people who were intuiting these things. Richard Neutra is another one, okay? There were a lot of people who weren't doing it, and that's because they were under different ideas. They were interested in mass production. They thought that, there was a theory, for example, in Germany in the 1920s that buildings should look as identical to one another as possible because modern man moved a lot, and therefore he would want to go to places that looked exactly the same in Munich as the one he's moving to in Heidelberg.
Yes.
And, you know, what my book shows is that there's a certain line of architectural thinking and design thinking, and that wins out, and we have the evidence for it.
And should part of getting to a world of better design and where everything mm-hmm. is well designed be making ourselves more aware and making others more aware of the world around them and becoming much more conscious.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, here's an analogy. You know, I don't know how old you are. I'm 58 years old. So when I was growing up, we didn't really think about what we ate. We just ate, right? You know, it was like food. You felt hungry. Then you ate something. You got away. So then there was this whole revolution in food. And suddenly we think we have to eat healthy, lots of vegetables. Food has become much more important in terms of what we eat, how we eat it, when we eat it, and so on and so forth, than it was when, certainly when I and my husband were growing up as kids.
Yeah.
I'm calling for the same kind of revolution here about the built environment.
Yeah, it's a powerful case that you make in the book. We've got just a couple of minutes left. I wonder, my favorite thing with books that I like is to find the things I want to argue with. So you predict that by 2050 we're going to have another almost 2.5 billion people needing new spaces built for them to live and work in. I can't imagine any design so good that's going to be, you know, survivable, that our ecosystem, that our climate. I mean, how can we plan for such a world? How can this planet even possibly support such a world?
Look, I'm all with you. That's too many people. It's going to be crushing and so on and so forth. But it's a little like saying, you know, climate change is so important. Why aren't you thinking about climate change? Well, a lot of things are important.
Yes.
But the built environment is also important. And I show why. That's the first answer to your question. The second is that there are a number of people who are breaking down the dimensions of design in such a way you can make these. I mean, they're going to be built anyway. That was my point in the book. This building is going to happen. You can do it better or you can do it worse.
Right.
And here are the consequences of doing it worse, and here are the consequences of doing it better. What do you want to do? And even in very large-scale buildings, there are people who are beginning to study and look at how you can make these, you know, these residential buildings in these unimaginably large megalopolises in Asia, for example, offer the kind of humanistic dimensions that people need when they live in habitat.
I think I'm afraid we're out of time.
Okay,
I wish
good.
We could go on for hours, but the book is a wonderful place to start. If we're going to have movement to have a better designed world, Welcome to Your World, How the Built Environment Shapes Our Lives by Sarah Williams Goldhagen. Sarah, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
David, it was my pleasure.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a 2017 Gallup poll found 61% of Americans approve of labor unions, despite the fact that just 11% of wage and salary workers are union members, and despite a decades-long, vehement, multi-layered, and deep-pocketed campaign to incapacitate unions, and really the ability of workers to organize in any way that truly builds power that could contest that of corporate interests. The ability of workers to build collective power is central in Janus versus AFSCME, a case currently before the Supreme Court. We'll talk about how efforts to weaken workers' voice masquerade as efforts to strengthen it and how we can see through them with Mary Batari, Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. Also on the show, polls show that Americans support universal health coverage. A Harvard-Harris survey from 2017 found 52% support for a single-payer system. Like support for unions, this support, too, has survived concerted, protracted, and well-funded efforts to undermine it. The latest comes from the nominally liberal Center for American Progress, whose Medicare Extra for All proposal is being branded a better single-payer by the same corporate media that have declared actual single-payer dead in the water, public be damned, for years. We'll talk about that with Margaret Flowers, co-director of Popular Resistance and coordinator of the National Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. That's coming up, but first we'll take a very quick look back at recent press. Media are famously quick to label something a trend. It's meant to explain why they're bringing you a story about some sort of newfangled donut or something. But sometimes the trend is the story and media ignore it. 2017 was an especially deadly year for anti-LGBTQ hate violence. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs found an 86% increase in homicides of LGBTQ people from the previous year. Of course, in a context of a White House with a declared disinterest in protecting the community's lives or rights. But the group Media Matters found that across 7 broadcast and cable networks, anti-LGBTQ violence was discussed only 22 times during the year. And in just 7 of those discussions did speakers contextualize the subject as part of this trend of increasing violence. More than half of the discussions focused on just 2 stories and took place over just a few days. And though Fox News spent the most time covering anti-LGBTQ violence at 10 minutes and 21 seconds for the whole of 2017, most of that was a single segment featuring disgraced LAPD Detective Mark Furman, of all people, defending the police officer who killed Scout Schultz, president of an LGBTQ student group at Georgia Tech. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When you hear the name of a court case, Smith versus Jones, there's a tendency to look for a story, a particular story, about Smith and Jones and which of them, given the details, seems most justified. Of course, there are ultimately individuals behind a case like Janus versus AFSCME, now before the Supreme Court. But to make sense of the case, you have to pull back and see the bigger story. In this case, that's one of a network of corporate and conservative organizations with a thought-out plan to redraw the country's legal political landscape more to their liking, including draining unions of their remaining power and influence. Helping workers and advocates to have at least awareness on our side is Mary Batari. She's deputy director of the Center for Media and Democracy, part of their critical ALEC Exposed investigation. Her report, Behind Janus, appears in the March issue of In These Times. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Mary Batari.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we won't stop at the particulars, but let's start there. Janus versus AFSCME Council 31, that's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, the biggest public service employees union. Janus is about whom and what is at issue?
Well, if you read the mainstream media, you'll get a whole bunch of detail about a child support worker named Mark Janus and his lonely battle against his union. And they'll also spend a whole lot of time explaining agency fees and fair share fees and how it all works when a person who is represented by a union but doesn't want to be a member of the union is required to pay a small portion of the fees that compensate the union for representing him. Okay, so now we've got the legalities out of the way. But what we're real story is and what we're trying to explain in the In These Times article aren't the details of Mark Janus's case, but a deep-pocketed, many-year, if not many-decade fight by very wealthy individuals, corporations, and foundations to dismantle unions in America. I mean, Mark Janus never had an original action. This lawsuit didn't seem to be his idea. He was put up to this by a large group of institutions and individuals who have been working quietly behind the scenes for years to dismantle unions.
Well, I want to draw you out. It's a network of advocacy and funding groups who are not just kind of ad hoc coming together around this issue and then around that issue where they find their interests are aligned. It's a pre-existing group with an agenda.
It's a pre-existing structure, and most people are aware that there's this group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, and it brings right-wing politicians and lobbyists together behind closed doors to develop, for instance, union-busting bills, to develop bills that privatize schools and those kinds of things. But that group has a sister group called the State Policy Network, and that's a group of 66 think tanks in the states, and they work very closely with ALEC on this sort of union-busting agenda. And so in red states, ALEC has worked hard to introduce bills to bust unions, like the right to work bills. And in blue states, the SPN groups have worked very hard to bring lawsuits to bust unions. And one of those lawsuits is now going up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that's the Janus case.
And that looks at public sector workers, but, you know, public sector workers, that union membership rate is about 34% as compared to 6.5% in the private sector. So it's more than five times higher in the public sector. But we shouldn't be fooled that Janus is just about public sector unions in particular. The longer term goal really has to do with all unions.
The long term goal is to take out what Grover Norquist says is a funding pillar of the Democratic Party, and that is unions and their boots on the ground, which is a very, very valuable asset. Organized people knocking on doors every election cycle is a very, very valuable asset. And what we did in our investigation is we portrayed the two faces of Janus. So here's the one face of Janus that's in the mainstream media, of this nice child support worker who's a Boy Scout and blah, blah, blah. But really, this case has very little to do with this person or his particulars. It has to do with this long history and this deep-moneyed assault. We did an analysis of all the groups. There's lots and lots of Amici briefs coming in on the side of this guy, Mark Janus, arguing why this is the right thing to do because workers like Mark Janus are having their free speech rights taken away and he deserves workplace freedom and all these kinds of things. Well, 13 of the 19 briefs came in from current or former members of State Policy Network. 17 of the 19 were filed by groups that had received funding from the Bradley Foundation or Donors Capital and Donors Trust. 17 of the 19, and one of the missing ones is, you know, a sort of subsidiary of one of the other groups. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So this is a very coordinated assault. And we looked at who funds all those groups. It's the Bradley Foundation, and it's Donors Capital and Donors Trust tied to the Koch brothers. So this agenda, it seems broad. There are many briefs from across the country, but in reality, it's a narrow group of people with a very determined agenda.
What keeps us from seeing that and being able to trace their operations in that way has to do with kind of the feints that get thrown up throughout the media in particular and the language. You know, you found, and it's in this In These Times report, that the State Policy Network in particular, they have rules about how they will talk, and the point is to sound as though you are not anti-union. Our other guest on the show was saying the fact that people want to co-opt the language around Medicare for All shows that the idea itself is popular, you know, which is why it's then such a betrayal to see that desire kind of turned back on people, or to see people fall for this idea. But these folks have a PR campaign that also is part of having us look away from what they're really doing. And in some sense, it's to say they're doing the exact opposite of what they're doing.
No, that's right. So in the public, all these groups talk about workers' rights. But in reality, these groups have been caught behind closed doors or in fundraising letters or in foundation memos saying something completely different. For instance, the head of the State Policy Network, Tracy Sharp, sent out a fundraising letter in 2016 asking her donors to strike a major blow to the left's ability to control government. And she says, "I'm writing to you today to share with you our bold plans to permanently break the power of unions this year." I mean, that's a very different language than, "Oh, we love Mark Janus and his free speech rights struggles," right? She's making it crystal clear that this entire agenda is about depriving the Democratic Party from access to millions of dollars.
And also, you cite Theda Skocpol making there be really no big power that can stand toe-to-toe with big business and with wealthy donors. You know, the power of unions just on the political playing field, such as it is, to gut that as well has a specific meaning. Well, one of the things that you note also is that gutting these public sector unions, part of that playbook includes pretending that it's about saving money, saying that we're broke and that's where the money has to come from. And that turns out to be BS.
Right. So folks will remember the Scott Walker attacked unions in the States, and he said, "There's nothing I can do. I have to get rid of collective bargaining because we just can't afford it anymore." But later, when he was testifying before Congress, he admitted that that wasn't the real reason, that it wasn't just because the state had taken a dip in its coffers. Similarly, this case actually originated with Bruce Rauner, the Republican governor of Illinois. And he is a multi-millionaire, if not billionaire, venture capitalist. And he decided to order the state by executive order to stop withholding fair share fees. And it was an assault on unions that was similar to Walker's. He similarly said, "We have to do it because we're broke because of the budget." And in truth, he was caught at the Hoover Institute in California in front of a more friendly audience, admitting it had nothing to do with the budget. This is a coordinated plan by Democratic governors. Bizarrely, this Rauner assault, he was told he didn't have standing. Groups came in with other workers who were state workers so that they'd have standing. Mark Janus was one of those workers. In a way, Mark Janus took over the suit from Rauner. And now all the media has forgotten that it started with Rauner. So this is a very deliberative, two-pronged attack on unions, one through governors and state houses in red states, and the other through blue state litigation.
It seems important to note also that when I think of public sector unions, we know that anything affecting them has an inordinate impact on people of color and on women who have traditionally found opportunity through government jobs and public sector jobs.
That is a very, very important point. Unions and public sector unions have been essential to shared prosperity. They've been essential to upward mobility ladder for women, for African Americans, and for other minority groups, just essential. And so what's going to happen if Janus rules against public sector unions is those jobs that have been so important to our shared prosperity are going to get worse and weakened, and public sector services themselves are going to get worse and weakened. And so it's not just about unions and union leadership and those kinds of things. It's about the public sectors in our society and making good paying jobs crap jobs. Is that really what we want our teachers' jobs to be like? Terrible jobs without good benefits and good pay? It's going to be a decision that's going to impact all of us.
Well, finally, some say the teacher strike in West Virginia shows that labor can have power as long as people will go out, you know, because many people think that the Supreme Court is going to rule against AFSCME. What next? You know, where should we be looking?
Some of my brothers and sisters in the labor movement think that West Virginia situation is exactly the right response. You know, when you have public sector workers who collectively bargain year after year after year, you have labor peace, and that's a huge benefit for especially kids in public education. Well, if they want to give away that huge benefit, then perhaps it's time for them to remember what it was like back in the days when we had wildcat teacher strikes. So that's definitely something that unions are taking a look at.
We've been speaking with Mary Batari, Deputy Director of the Center for Media and Democracy, online at prwatch.org. Her report, Behind Janus, Documents Reveal Decade-Long Plot to Kill Public Sector Unions, appears in the March issue of In These Times. Mary Batari, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much for having me.
When you hear that Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Jamie Dimon have a plan to fix healthcare, questions, shall we say, naturally arise about how transformative it's likely to be, this plan of super wealthy corporate executives that they insist would be free from profit-making incentives and constraints. But if the plan comes from a group represented as liberal, and its spokespeople talk about universal coverage and health care as a right, and the New York Times declares it a better single-payer plan, well, what are you to think? Here to help us see what's going on in a new health care proposal that you will be hearing about is Margaret Flowers. Margaret Flowers is co-director of Popular Resistance and coordinator of the National Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Margaret Flowers.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I guess I have a straightforward question. What is it this Medicare extra for all plan? It certainly sounds good.
Sure. To people who are not policy wonks, it sounds great because it uses the language that the movement for a single-payer health care plan has been using for a long time, Medicare for all. But what the plan that the Center for American Progress is proposing is actually just another try at the public option that was put out there back in 2008, 2009, during the time when we had the health reform process in Congress under the Obama administration. So it's just creating an opportunity for people to join Medicare, including the private insurance portion of Medicare, which is known as the Medicare Advantage plans. It's another attempt at incremental health reform that doesn't actually get at the root of the problems, but uses the language of the movement for health reform.
Well, when I read accounts, I see, you know, from the Center for American Progress itself, they say Medicare Extra for All would guarantee universal coverage and eliminate underinsurance. What are they talking about with that claim?
Well, this is exactly the same terms that were used when the Affordable Care Act was put together. So you think about the time of the Affordable Care Act, there was a very strong public support for a national improved Medicare for All or single-payer health plan. the members of Congress who are funded by the industries that are profiting off of our current health system didn't want to go against their campaign funders, but had to do something that was appealing to the public. So they said it will be affordable, guaranteed, and universal. We knew that it was never going to be any of those things. And they used something called a public option to convince single-payer supporters that they were asking for too much and this was more politically feasible and that it would be a backdoor to single-payer. And a lot of people fell for it. This is exactly the same tactics being used again. The Affordable Care Act is, you know, resulting in the things that we predicted that it would: high insurance premiums, high out-of-pocket costs for people so that they may have insurance but not be able to use it. A lot of people are saying, you know, we don't want to go backwards, but we also don't want to fix the Affordable Care Act. We're ready for a national improvement of care for all. We're ready to join the rest of the world. So how do members of Congress and their supporting institutions once again try to convince the public to do something that's less than what they want? And that's what this whole proposal is about.
Well, I find it so continually frustrating. In the media coverage, we see AP referring to political pragmatism in talking about this plan from the Center for American Progress. David Leonard at the New York Times used the term realpolitik. The insistence with which corporate media declare that things that the majority of the public want, and in this case that other countries around the world have been doing for years, that they're just not politically possible, and that, you know, well, sure, we all want them, but you just can't achieve them. You know, at FAIR, we call that things being not journalistically viable. You know, it's something where the corporate elites simply say it can't be done. But why can't it be done?
Well, there's no reason that it can't be done. We're already spending enough money in the United States to provide a high quality, comprehensive health coverage to every single person living here. We pay twice as much as the average other wealthy nation does on health care, and they cover everyone. They have better health outcomes. They have a longer life expectancy. What's interesting is the same tactic was tried at the end of last summer. There was a very strong push, as people may remember, in Congress with the Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And out of that, people were pushing to not repeal it, but to actually push for a single-payer healthcare system. And so in August and September, there was a whole round of articles coming out. And I looked at them and I kind of boiled down what their talking points were, and they were all the same. Single-payer advocates are asking for too much change at once. They don't have the details worked out. Other countries don't have pure single-payer systems. There's too much opposition. We can't do it all, you know, at once. We have to do what's politically feasible. And the same arguments are being used again this time. The reality is that our healthcare crisis is not going to be solved until we get the private insurance industry out of it. They add nothing but complication and sucking money out of our systems for their own profit. And that's what a single-payer healthcare system does. The majority of the public support it. We are starting to get record numbers of members of Congress who feel that they have to get on board with it. Our movement is actually starting to win. And when you look at the history of successful social movements, we can expect these exact tactics that the power holders are going to say, right, we're on your side. We want to do what you want, but they're actually not doing it. So this is a time for us to be pushing harder. We can change the political feasibility. That's something that the public has the power to do.
Now, are there specific pieces of legislation that exist right now, something concrete that people can be talking about being for?
Absolutely. We have legislation in the House called H.R. 676, the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act. It's been introduced every session since 2003, and it was really based on principles and a framework that was put together by advocates for a single-payer healthcare system. We have over 120 co-sponsors in the House right now. More than half of the Democrats have signed on to it. Lots of Democrats who are running for congressional seats are running on a platform of support for it. And then Senator Sanders introduced a bill in the Senate last year, S-1804, called the Medicare for All Act. It purports to do a single-payer healthcare system. It has some weaknesses, but also some strengths. It's not as ideal as H.R. 676, but it's another piece of legislation in the Senate.
Let me just ask you briefly. So when, you know, someone's out to dinner and someone says, hey, Center for American Progress, they're a liberal group and they've got this Medicare for all, Medicare extra for all. It sounds really good. What does one say in terms of explaining why this is not single payer? What's a kind of succinct way to get that across?
Well, the basic thing is that it keeps the complicated private insurance system that we have here intact and just adds more people into the public system. And so health insurance is going to continue to be expensive. It will continue to deny people care, and people will still face financial barriers like co-pays and deductibles.
Calling it Medicare Extra for All, saying it guarantees universal coverage, saying it eliminates underinsurance, it's just deceptive.
Right. It says that people are eligible or are able to buy into Medicare, but we're going to keep the other parts of our system intact, the employer system, the other private plans that are out there. So it's the language that they use. Under a national improved Medicare for All, when it starts, everybody is in the system all at once. It's not that people are eligible, they're in. And that's the difference.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Margaret Flowers. She's co-director of Popular Resistance and coordinator of the National Health Over Profit for Everyone campaign. You can get more information on healthoverprofit.org. Margaret Flowers, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Did a comet strike the Earth 12,800 years ago, causing global wildfires and starting an age of cooling? Scientists are still arguing whether that happened. In this show, we start with Dr. Joanne Ballard, a co-author of two new papers with evidence that it did happen. I'll follow with comet expert Mark Boslow. He says the science behind this hypothesis is flawed. Then I'll close with my own impressions of the science, the believers, and why all this matters a lot for our future. After all, the next comet strike can come at any time. This is Radio EcoShock. Let's go. In the second week of February 2018, two unexpected comets passed by the Earth, and they came closer than the Moon. The mystery is, why have we not been hit by a large rock from space during the human times, at least as much as we can remember? A group of scientists say there was a strike around 12,000 years ago. They claim it darkened Earth with fires on multiple continents, wiping out large animals, and kicking off a cooling period known as the Younger Dryas. Around 2006, a couple of books were published on this comet strike, with lots of media coverage. There was also pushback from other scientists, claiming it never happened or there wasn't enough evidence. Two new papers have been published in the Journal of Geology. The lead author in both is Wendy S. Wolbach, along with 26 other scientists. To make the case for a climate-changing, extinction-level comet strike just a few thousand years before the discovery of agriculture and the rise of civilization, here is co-author Joanne P. Ballard. Dr. Ballard is an archaeologist for the Tennessee Valley Authority in Knoxville. Joanne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, too. You know, there's so much to this story, but why don't we start with this? Talk to us about the trail of extraordinary fires found by your group happening around 12,800 years ago. How big were they, and how do we know that they happened?
Okay, well, this paper initially was a response to the 2009 Jennifer Marlin paper that came out where she synthesized 35 charcoal records across North America. But she did not have very many records across the Midwest, and their results were, we don't really see a peak for the onset of the Younger Dryas. So since then, I have developed several charcoal records, actually from Four Lakes in Michigan, and so that's been added. And Jacqueline Gill and Katie Leininger also contributed charcoal data sets from Indiana and Ohio. And so those have helped fill in a gap where we didn't have any data. And so in this paper by Wolbach and others, there's 152 charcoal records. So we've got a larger data set. And this time, when we run the statistics on it, it does show a peak at the beginning of the Younger Dryas.
And some of those fires, though, were they in Africa or Europe or other places besides North America?
I think that we used in this paper data sets from North America.
Okay.
I think the focus is on North America. And then to support that, because that's just, you know, one aspect. You're just looking at charcoal, and it's an imperfect proxy. So we need other lines of evidence, and one of these would be the Greenland ice cores, the gold standard for paleo environments. So we look at chemical markers in those to support combustion. And there's certain chemicals in there, such as formate, oxalate, ammonium, that give an indication of broad-scale combustion, biomass burning. And so we do see peaks in those chemicals for the onset of the Younger Dryas. That helps support the idea that, you know, there was a widespread wildfire event at the beginning of the Younger Dryas.
Just to get an idea of your work, you personally presented a conference paper in 2014 on the late glacial fires in Alabama and Michigan. What did you find?
So that was presented at the Southeastern Archaeological Conference in Greenville, South Carolina. And the sites were Cahaba Pond, Alabama, which had been worked on before by Hazel Delcourt. She, in fact, collected the cores and did pollen analysis on the cores. And so that gives us insight into the vegetation that was growing in the lake basin. And so if you core different lakes over a larger region, you get a pretty good picture of what was growing there 14,000 years ago, 13,000 years ago, and so on into the Holocene. So the Cahaba Pond record started at 14,000 years ago, and beech was the dominant species, along with a lesser species that was there at the pond was hop hornbeam. And both of those species are fire intolerant. So we would not expect to see lots of fires if these trees are thriving. So they're coming along doing well. And then in the Younger Dryas, there's a drastic change. The beech and hop hornbeam go away, and oak and southern pines become the dominant species there. And you can see in the core itself, there's some kind of dramatic change from mineral-rich to organic-rich sediment in the pond. So this was a very intriguing core to work on. So then I wanted to do the charcoal analysis. And is there any other proxy I can use to look for something unusual across the Younger Dryas boundary, across the Lake Glacial? So together with Stephen Dreese, who is a soil scientist at Baylor, he was on my committee at the University of Tennessee, we used thin sections. So these are paper-thin slices of epoxied mud, and this technique is usually applied to soils, but we decided we wanted to try it on lake sediments. What microstructures can we see? And we got a very intriguing result, and that is there were these structures in there that are siliceous aggregates. And the initial question was, well, where did they come from and what does this mean? So it turns out that they form from wood ash. So wood ash is another byproduct of fire. And the wood ash, there's little silica structures in the twigs, bark, and leaves of trees. And when they burn, those phytoliths are in the ash. And in that highly alkaline environment, as you get water percolating through the ash, that silica turns to a gel. And if there is silt, which would be dust, another word for silt is dust, the silica gel sticks to the silt substrate and hardens up, and this is remaining evidence of a wildfire. So the interesting thing about finding those siliceous aggregates at Cahaba Pond is, you know, there are actually six sites that we looked at. Five of them had siliceous aggregates during the Lake Glacial. So we also looked in Anderson Pond at other periods of time in the core, because we don't want to, like, say that they're specific to the Lake Glacial if it's a common thing. But actually, we did not find any in Holocene sediments. So this, to me, looks like another potential marker for some event. But we need to do more work on this because it is a promising new proxy for wildfire that would supplement charcoal data, soot, and soot data, and so on.
Boy, we're looking for the footprints of fire more than 12,000 years ago and finding them. That's kind of exciting stuff. I have to say, one of my listeners, who is a geologist who also tracks hits from outer space, he suggests these fires could have natural causes. And he's talking about a peak temperature that generally ends the warmer states known as stadials just before cooling time, like the Younger Dryas. Could the fires that you've discovered and discussed in your paper have been simply due to climate change rather than a comet strike?
Okay, Alex, this is an excellent question and one that I've asked myself. So how do we differentiate? Because we have forest fires today. Some of them are fairly large. You know, it's a common thing in the boreal forests of Canada to have forest fires. So how do we differentiate that we've got a catastrophic wildfire situation? So this is where a multi-proxy approach has to be used. So you look for something else that distinguishes those fires from other wildfires. So in the biomass burning paper, in addition to the charcoal, we looked at soot. We supplemented with the platinum peak, although that's more of an extraterrestrial signature, but also the chemical markers for biomass burning in the ice cores. And those are ammonium formate, oxalate, and levoglucosan would be a good marker to analyze for, but that's only been done for the historical part of the Greenland ice cores.
On Radio EcoShock, scientists like Alan Robach explained nuclear winter that would follow a nuclear exchange, and other scientists have told us about a darkening that lasted for several years after an asteroid strike hit around the Gulf of Mexico 66 million years ago. What evidence does your group present to suggest there was an impact winter around 12,800 years ago?
Well, I talked to Wendy Walbeck about this because she's the soot expert, and she said we estimate YDB being the Younger Dryas boundary, the 12,800 years ago. We estimate a YDB soot footprint of 15 milligrams per square centimeters. When this amount of soot is injected into the atmosphere, the amount of time it stays aloft depends on how high it goes, a minimum of 7 days, more if it makes it into the stratosphere. So the soot's going to stay there longer if it's injected up into the stratosphere. She estimated that depending on how high up the soot went, and that it doesn't take a whole lot of soot to block out quite a bit of sunlight, She estimated darkness for months to a year. And she's comparing to the Cretaceous Paleogene event. That's where they estimated months to a year. And so I would say not over a year for the Younger Dryas event.
So the key to the whole Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, as it's known, is a hit by an object from outer space. What does your group think happened?
I consulted with Bill Napier on this, the astronomer in our group, and he says that we consider a swarm of Tunguska-like impacts yielding multiple fireballs worldwide are much more likely to have occurred than maybe a large asteroid or something like that, and can account very well for the wildfires in Walbach et al. 2018. Such impacts would not usually leave craters, although we could certainly not rule out one or two larger objects as part of the mix.
So this was something that broke up in the air and then hit in multiple places at more or less the same time.
It could have, because there are also fires in Europe, and I have studied, they're called the Oslo Horizon. And it's a burn-rich layer that dates to approximately the beginning of the Younger Dryas that is in the cover sands there. And so I've studied four different sites over there, and those include, they're charcoal-rich, there's algae, there's sponge spicules, there's fused quartz, and there's melt glass in those layers. So that's suggesting a thermal pulse. So, but going back to what was the nature of this, you know, we're still trying to figure that out. If the impactor or impactors struck the Laurentide ice sheet, which was 2 miles thick and covered most of Canada, most of eastern Canada, you wouldn't have a crater. There'd be a lot of meltwater, and we do, in fact, see meltwater pulse 1A at the beginning of the Younger Dryas. So that is consistent with something sudden. And the Younger Dryas is pretty well agreed that the onset was very sudden. From the ice cores and from other proxies, it was a fairly sudden thing.
There was a book in 2006 that I found. It's titled The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. Among the co-authors are two contributing authors to the new papers we're talking about in the Journal of Geology. That was Richard Firestone and Alan West. Are these two papers intended as further proof of the theory proposed in that book?
Bill Napier responded to this question because he was more familiar with that book. He said the original scenario in that book was a supernova exploded in our neighborhood 41,000 years ago and gave rise to a series of destructive shock waves as well as disturbing comets, and they were thrown in our direction. So he says this is untenable astronomically, but the ideas of the group have evolved, not randomly, but towards a pre-existing hypothesis, namely that we ran through the debris tail of a giant short period disintegrating comet whose orbit sometimes intersects the Earth.
How would this arrival or impact drive large animals in North America into extinction?
Well, those that survived the initial blast and the wildfires and the shock waves would then be subjected to nitric acid rain, which is associated with, when you have a shock wave associated with an impact, it dissociates the nitrogen in the atmosphere, in the ozone layer, breaks up the ozone layer, you get nitrates, and they'll rain out of the atmosphere for months to maybe a year. So that would suppress regrowth or reestablishment of the vegetation in the area. So their habitat would be destroyed. So if they survive the first impact, then they have to deal with destruction of their habitat. So that's going to be pretty challenging. And so with that acid rain has been well studied for its effects, like in Appalachia and Scandinavia, since the industrial age began. It's been a problem. So we know a lot about that. And it damages the leaves on trees. It kills off aquatic organisms, fish, salamanders, and so on. So it would also suppress, like, sprouting of seeds and would probably kill off the seeds. And then it's going to take a very long time for animals and other vectors of dispersal to bring in seeds to repopulate the area with plants and trees. And the other aspect of the acid rain associated with an impact would be that it's a nutrient input. So it's nitrogen, and although it has a destructive pH, it's also a nutrient, and so you get massive algal blooms. And so for pollen diagrams and diatom diagrams at the beginning of the Younger Dryas, that's what we see. We see a lot of diatom blooms, algal blooms. And in fact, one of the characteristic features that we see in sediments for the beginning of the Younger Trias is these so-called black mats that have been studied by Vance Haynes and others, Jay Quaid. So these are algal-rich layers that have like these carbon spherules and magnetite grains. So why do we suddenly have all these algal overgrowth at that time? So that would be my hypothesis for that. And we should be studying a lot more nitrogen records, nitrogen isotopes, to try and see if there's a common link there.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Has Earth really escaped a large strike from outer space during our human time? From Tennessee, we are talking with Dr. Joanne Ballard about two new papers that say a big hit changed the Earth relatively recently. Joanne, the NASA Center for Near-Earth Object Studies says no large impacts have occurred in the last 15,000 years. Your group disputes that?
Yes, and Bill Napier has answered this question. He said you might be thinking that the YDB was triggered by an object from outer space, but instead, you know, instead of the initial Firestone idea of a 4-kilometer-wide comet, he considers large impacts are red herring, and proposes, as we said before, the swarm of Tunguska-like impacts yielding multiple fireballs worldwide. And in my view, we might not be able to recognize all the impacts on Earth because a lot of them are unrecognized. We're a watery planet, and some of those impacts, if they go into the ocean, if they're not as large, I guess, we won't see them. If there's impacts in a forest region, the vegetation will close up and cover it up, and in desert situations. So I think the number is probably higher than recognized.
Let's get to the evidence, Joanne. The two papers look into the records provided by ice cores and glaciers, which you mentioned, and lake and marine and terrestrial sediments, which is more your specialty. There's a wide range of very technical isotopes and rare elements being talked about in these papers and in this subject generally. I find it's a little too detailed for me to grasp. What would you present as the top one or two proofs that this kind of event happened?
Well, I would say the iridium and platinum that we found, a platinum spike in the ice core. So I'd say that's pretty significant. And also, if we can find platinum in our sedimentary record as well, that would, I think, be a very, very strong supporting evidence.
Now, as you know, some scientists have been critical of the evidence. For example, Professor Nicholas Pinter, who's with the University of California, Davis now, he wrote a requiem for this hypothesis. Others say they've performed blind tests and failed to duplicate the evidence presented. How would you answer those critics, Joanne?
Well, I'd say for the Pinter requiem paper, one thing they challenged was the carbon spherules, and they proposed that these things found in the YDB layer could easily be termite poop or fungal spores. I find that kind of ridiculous because the carbon spherules, to me, are just a combustion indicator. And so they form from combustion of forests, particularly coniferous forests. They just seem very biased in their approach. So, and then there's also the Surville paper where they tried to replicate and they could not find the same indicators, but they didn't use the recommended methodology. They did not separate their fractions. That means take the sediment and sieve it and sort it into fractions and then look. So I think that might explain why they had difficulty replicating the results.
What holds your group of 29 authors together? Is there an inspirational person who first expressed this theory, or who would you say are leaders in the field now?
Well, I would say the group has the common interest of wanting to contribute more to this fascinating debate. You know, the charismatic woolly mammoths, what happened to them, and all the other 34 large mammals that used to be here and are now gone. We're a very collaborative group, and I'm glad to be part of it. I would say that the inspirational person for me is probably Rick Firestone. So I learned about this hypothesis from him when I attended a paleontology conference at the Mammoth site in Hot Springs, South Dakota. And it really was very interesting that here's this, you know, up till then, the hypotheses for why did the mammoths go extinct were overhunting by people, climate change, and hyper disease. So now here we have this new fourth hypothesis, very intriguing. And so after that conference, I went on to be a graduate student at the University of Cincinnati. Tom Lowell was my advisor there, and studied lake sediments for charcoal, looking for this big peak at the Younger Dryas. That was what I predicted. Oh, I'll find a big peak. Well, science and nature are not that cut and dried and simple. So yes, there were peaks. In one of them, there was a definite peak at the Younger Dryas in the four lakes that we sampled. But in the others, there were peaks, but there were also additional peaks. So this is where I know that you need to have additional lines of evidence. You can't just single out one and say, oh, this peak must be the one. So you have your supporting evidence that helps you figure out what's what. But Rick Firestone has taken a lot of criticism for introducing a new idea to science, but I'm really glad he had the gumption to do it.
This seems to be a big topic for Russian researchers as well, and I suppose that's natural considering the big hit in Siberia in 1908 and the recent surprise strike in Chelyabinsk, Russia, in February 2013. The Siberian division of the Russian Academy of Sciences hold two databases of reported hits, and they evaluate them. Has anybody in your group talked with the Russian counterparts?
Okay, I heard from Bill Napier on this one, Alex, because he's the astronomer, and so this is more along his line of study. And he said the British cometary astronomers do indeed liaise with Russian colleagues from time to time. And Bill attended a conference in Moscow in 2008 for the 100th anniversary of the Tunguska impact. However, our interest is mainly in assessing the celestial hazard from a theoretical point of view involving cometary dynamics rather than specific impacts such as Chelyabinsk. Our connections are international, say with American or Japanese colleagues, as much as with Russians. And I would say from a paleontology point of view, I keep up with the work of Sergei Leshinsky and other Russian researchers on the mammoth side of it. There's a lot of different aspects to this hypothesis.
There is, and it's really interesting to me, Joanne, because what you're talking about is also something that could happen at any time. We just had something appear out of the sky that they only saw 5 days ahead of it arriving. So humans could experience another hit.
They could. And once again, Bill Napier says that there's a lot of effort going into detecting potential impact threats, and which I was unaware of. In 2016, NASA established an office for detecting asteroids, coordinating responses, cooperating with emergency management agencies, and the like. This is an international effort involving telescopes in Hawaii, Arizona, Japan, Australia, and other places. The aim is to discover 90% of threatening objects down to 140 meters, which would be 50 feet, yielding a 200 megaton impact, 140 meters in diameter, by the end of 2020. There's also an operational center in Frascati, Italy, under the aegis of the European Space Agency. So there's a lot going on in terms of detecting small asteroids. At the moment, discovery is very incomplete, as we see from the fact that small asteroids are discovered often as not after they have passed us, as we've seen in some recent episodes of that.
So in the end, Joanne, do you think this research that's being done is being treated fairly?
Well, whenever you roll out a new hypothesis and you challenge paradigms, you're going to get some pushback. It's kind of frustrating when people are closed-minded or they won't consider it. So I was at a conference in Los Angeles in, I think it was 2014, and there was a speaker who was talking about the Younger Dryas impact, and he said, oh, that's been disproven. And I thought, well, no, it hasn't, because there's been several new papers on it. So I spoke up at the end of the session about that. And he wasn't very pleased. I thought, you know, that's very biased to try and tell everybody it's no longer a viable hypothesis when there's a lot going on with it.
I'm impressed by the amount of detailed studies that are needed to present a big theory like this. Joanne, what will you research next?
Oh, I've got a long list. I'll have a paper coming out with three new charcoal records for the southeastern U.S., and this is an area where there are very few charcoal records, especially those that go back 20,000 years. I'll also have the paper on the siliceous aggregates, explaining in detail about those. And then I have a paleontological study I'm working on, which is called the Telltale Tusk, where we found a dissolved tusk. Well, one of my paleontology friends has it. It's a dissolved mammoth tusk that dates to the Younger Dryas, and I hypothesize that maybe the dissolution is from nitric acid rain. So I presented this at a Greek conference in 2014, but we need more examples of that and try and co-date them and try and get more focus on that. There, I also have samples from the Netherlands, from the Usalo burn layers, and I would like to do more work on those. And I think it would be interesting to research the muck beds in Alaska because there are a lot of Pleistocene fossils and animals, trees. It's a very intriguing place to study late glacial dynamics, but challenging because of the nature of the sediments up there. There's solifluction and the sediments get mixed up. So, and Malcolm Lecomte says he has unreported evidence for a major Tunguska scale event that destroyed half a dozen Middle Bronze Age cities in the Jordan River Valley. So that apparently will be a paper that's coming out.
We're starting to run out of time. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners?
Well, I would say if you want to learn more about this, one good source on the internet is the website The Cosmic Tusk. And so George Howard, one of the members of the group, he posts like any news about anything to do with the onset of the Younger Dryas.
I'll check it out for sure. From Knoxville, Tennessee, we've been speaking with Dr. Joanne P. Ballard. She is co-author of two new papers published in February 2018 in the Journal of Geology. The papers advance the hypothesis that a large object from outer space in some way moved by or struck the Earth about 12,800 years ago, with dire consequences for plant and animal life, plus a major change in the climate. Thank you so much for talking with us, Joanne.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith, and you can find links in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Some scientists disagree with the idea that a killer comet struck the Earth 12,800 years ago. One of them is physicist and space objects expert Dr. Mark Boslow. He is a technical advisor for Sandia National Laboratories and adjunct professor at the University of New Mexico. Mark calls for planetary defense, but he doesn't like this hypothesis of a Younger Dryas impact. From Albuquerque, New Mexico, Mark Boslow, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You've been on a lot of great programs. I have seen you myself on TV, and I know you as a pioneer of the Airbuster space rocks idea that can cause significant damage, but they're not like age-ending catastrophes. Should we worry less about big asteroids and more about smaller space debris?
Well, I've argued that we should. And I should back up. I am now retired from Sandia Labs. I retired last June, and I'm sorry, I probably haven't updated everything on the web yet. But most of this work I did when I was a staff member at Sandia. I'm now at University of New Mexico.
Fair enough. And about the idea of the big asteroids, I mean, we've seen Bruce Willis on the screen trying to fight them off with nuclear weapons. But what happens when these smaller bits hit the Earth? Why should we be concerned?
Well, there's really a couple reasons why I have argued that most of the risk, at least half of the risk, is in these small ones. One is we've discovered most of the big ones that are on Earth-crossing orbits that have the potential to hit the Earth, the really big catastrophic ones. We've discovered something like 90% of those since the effort began to find them about 20 years ago. The second reason is that my models and the models of others now show that small asteroids create an airburst that's actually more damaging than an equivalent explosion from a nuclear weapon. And in the past, most of our estimate for risk came from damage from the nuclear weapons effects literature. So we've kind of updated that in the last 10 or 15 years.
So you're one of the big names in that field, and yet you're a leading critic of the Unger-Dryas impact event hypothesis. From your perspective, what are some of the problems with that idea?
Well, I guess my first problem is I don't know exactly what the hypothesis is, because each one of their papers seems to state it somewhat differently. Their original paper was the one that Firestone was the lead author of. That was in 2007. And at that point, they were pretty loose with their definition of the hypothesis. And they said, well, it was a comet or a broken comet or asteroid that either exploded in the atmosphere or in space or hit an ice sheet. And so they didn't really differentiate among these various hypotheses, and they kind of had the bases covered. And since then, it seems to have evolved quite a bit. And they don't always state it in the same terms.
Dr. Nicholas Pinter and others published a requiem for the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis, and a year later you published another paper with arguments and evidence against it. What do you now make of the two new papers published by the same group in the Journal of Geology?
Well, I have to say I spent some time last night and this morning reading those, and I mostly focused on the areas where my expertise lies, and that is impact physics and the physics of airbursts. And to me, there's really nothing new. In fact, a lot of it just either ignores or misrepresents our criticisms. And so I didn't find them to add much, if anything, to their argument.
Our guest Joanne Ballard told us the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis has been evolving, as you say, and at one point they seemed to suggest a breakup of a space rock then started giant fires on several continents at the same time. Do you think that is possible or likely?
Well, it doesn't really make sense to me, and I and a lot of others have questioned the details of how that could work, how something could break up with just the exquisite timing for all the pieces to hit the Earth, but widely separated enough that they cause fires but do not cause impact craters. There's no impact crater from this event. And so it would have to have broken up just before hitting the Earth, but before it could spread out enough that, you know, only a few of the objects would hit the Earth. And the timing would have to be perfect. And that just, to me, kind of adds to the extremely low probability of what they're suggesting happened.
At least two of the co-authors of these new papers are not scientists, as far as I can tell. One is listed in various places as Dr. Alan West or as geophysicist Alan West, but I can't find support for either of those titles. I asked Alan West for an interview. He declined. Is Alan West's lack of credentials important for assessing the samples that he gathered for some of the earlier research?
Well, I have to say, in science, trust really matters, and reputation really matters. Ronald Reagan used to say, trust but verify, and that actually was a Russian proverb. And I think I'd kind of turn it around, and I'd say something like, verify before you trust. And I don't have any verified information about Alan West. I know he's been under intense scrutiny, and there was an article by science reporter Rex Dalton a few years ago talking about his role in this, and pointing out that he didn't have any background, or at least there was no evidence for a background. And I haven't seen any background that he's actually got the training or experience to do what he contributes to these papers.
Another co-author of the two new papers is George Howard. According to his online profile, Mr. Howard has a BA in political science from the University of North Carolina. George Howard has a blog called The Cosmic Tusk, and that was recommended to listeners by our guest Joanne Ballard. The Cosmic Tusk blog has a list of articles slamming you, Mark Boslaw. How did you develop that special relationship?
Yeah, that's sort of outside the way normal science is done. I mean, we do like to have our vigorous debates at scientific conferences. Usually they don't get personal. I don't try to get bogged down in any kind of personal insult type debate. Some people, I think, find it insulting when you criticize the science, and I think George may be one of those.
Now, Mark Boslow, you have a record of going after anti-science and climate denial. How does this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis get used by climate deniers like Anthony Watt?
Well, I know he's run a few articles about it. I don't know what his position. I don't read his blog, or I rarely look at it.
Really? I'm surprised.
But I know, so Wally Broker, who actually is probably one of the most famous living earth scientists, he's at Columbia University, and he was quoted in that Rex Dalton story saying, you know, this whole controversy with Alan West's background says it does feed the distrust of science. Those who don't believe in human-produced global warming grab onto it. And Wally is actually the guy who coined the term global warming back in his 1975 paper in which he predicted a lot of what we've now experienced.
I think what the deniers want to do is to say, well, look, these things aren't part of any natural cycle. We can't look at the ice ages and changing climates because, after all, it was just caused by a rock from space, and that's more convenient for them.
Well, I think Wally's right. They tend to grab onto anything, whether there's merit to it or not.
Are you aware of any evidence of a crater showing the impact claimed? And if not, could the crater have escaped our notice, say, hidden in the ocean or by landing on a deep ice field like the Laurentide ice sheet?
You know, I looked at that problem. They had suggested a 4-kilometer diameter object hitting the Laurentide ice sheet. And, you know, if it were that big, it would have punched right through and made a big hole in a bedrock. And there's nothing like that. If it was a 4-kilometer diameter object that broke up into a bunch of pieces, well, it's extremely unlikely that they'd all hit the Laurentide ice sheet. And a crater that young and that big, that recent, it wouldn't have subducted. There would be very little erosion. I mean, it would literally still be steaming. The tiny little meteor crater, Arizona, is 50,000 years old, not just 12,000, but, you know, something like a factor of 4 older. And it looks fresh. It looks brand new, and it's tiny. I mean, it's many orders of magnitude smaller than what they're suggesting here. And likewise, there's an impact structure. It's buried, and it took a while to be discovered after the Cretaceous Paleogene boundary event was first proposed in 1980. But it's huge. It's a monster, and it's something like 500 times older, if I did that right in my head that fast. It's 65 million years old, 66 million years old.
You know, the media loves stories of comets and asteroids striking the Earth and causing havoc. Do you think that fascination helps keep this Younger Dryas impact hypothesis going?
I do. I mean, there's a natural human fascination, and that's good. I mean, anything that keeps people interested in science and in the sky and in astronomy, in my opinion, is a good thing. But I think both, you know, your profession in journalism and my profession in science, we have to keep everything a little bit reined in and grounded. And in fact, that is one of the things I do as chair of the Asteroid Day expert panel. So we formed this organization called Asteroid Day. And part of the purpose of this panel we set up is to get experts to make sure that everything we say, everything that goes out is from Asteroid Day, the organization has a press release or as an answer to someone's question, is scientifically correct and defensible. So I think that's really important. And a lot of what we find ourselves doing is chasing down some of these clickbait stories about the next asteroid that's going to destroy the Earth. And those seem to appear with regular frequency.
Yeah, the planet Nibiru, I think it is going to come and get us. Well, it was going to come and get us, and then the dates come and pass. You know?
I think that one may have come and gone.
Yeah. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Boslow, an expert in planetary defense against objects from outer space. And that's the next thing I want to talk to you about, Mark. Are the big institutions like NASA or the EU space program, can they reliably warn us if something from outer space is going to hit us?
Well, I think anything really big, we would have advance warning. Maybe not as much as we would like. I mean, the problem is really big things that would be big enough to take out an entire continent, say, we would have to employ some kind of planetary defense scheme and actually deflect it. I mean, that would be what everyone would hope. But that is going to take something like a decade of lead time. And we don't have a guarantee with our current resources that we would find something with that much time. The smaller ones, the Tunguska-sized or meteor crater-sized events, there's a really good chance we wouldn't see those at all. They may be coming on an orbit. They may be in an orbit that would bring them in from the direction of the sun, and we wouldn't see them at all. We would get zero warning, just like the Chelyabinsk event of February 2013.
Well, it used to be that humans were not very concentrated. They were spread all over the place. But now we have mega cities. I think that increases the chance that one of these things could strike in a heavily populated area.
Well, and it did, and Chelyabinsk did do that. Fortunately, it was only roughly 20 meters in diameter. It was about a half a megaton explosion, and it was 40 kilometers to the south of the city where that energy, you know, was transferred to the atmosphere, creating this big explosion. But it came in at a shallow angle, which spread its energy out over a larger area, so more people experienced it, but the shockwave was actually less intense, and nobody was killed. And that could happen again. But we estimate that an event of that size happens somewhere on Earth roughly once every 50 years. The next one could hit a city. Again, the probability of that is low. I mean, people are concentrated, but cities, you know, if you look at the map of the Earth, cities don't cover that much of a percentage of the Earth's surface.
And it could always just hit the ocean anyway.
Could hit the ocean. Yep. And there's also we also have a concern of tsunami, airburst generated tsunami, and I've worked with tsunami modelers to try to estimate how bad that would be. Right now, I don't think we've come to a full consensus. There are a lot of people that I think have come to dismiss that idea. I'm not so sure it should be dismissed yet. I think there's still work to be done.
On a personal note, Mark, you turned a private property fight with off-roaders in Colorado into an important new argument, I think, in climate, and that is, talk to us about the right to radiate.
Okay, well, I did blog about that, and it's an idea I've had for some time, and really, it's kind of a libertarian argument, and I know it's funny because a lot of the people who reject the science of climate change don't reject it on the basis of science. They reject it on the basis of what they want to believe. And I think a lot of libertarians or, you know, more conservative people with libertarian ideas, their values want to reject it because it would require some kind of government intervention, and they tend to be sort of against government regulations. So my idea is to kind of get around that libertarian resistance by saying, geez, you know, we have private property rights. And the way we actually cool ourselves, whether it's our private property or the Earth, is we radiate heat into space. It goes up into space, and some fraction of it just keeps going and disappears, and that keeps us cooled off like a cooling fin. But greenhouse gas pollution gets in the way. It absorbs that radiation, and it actually turns around and radiates it back at us. But we've established an easement. An easement is a right-of-way, and that's part of private property rights. So my argument is, well, you could sue the polluter for taking away your private property rights. And in the United States, that's a constitutional right. The Fifth Amendment says you cannot take private property for public use without due process, and there's been no due process in that. So it's kind of a constitutional argument that I think would appeal to libertarians if they thought it through.
And what are you working on these days, Mark?
Well, mostly proposals. I retired in June. I've been very busy. A lot of what I've been doing is public speaking and writing, spending time with my family. But I did spend the entire week last week writing a couple proposals for modeling airbursts on Mars and on Jupiter. And I hope at least one of those gets funded, because I'd like to work on this problem again, but more from a planetary science perspective and maybe a little bit less from a risk perspective, planetary defense perspective.
Why would it matter if there's an airburst on Mars?
Oh, there is a mission to Mars that's going to be launched, hopefully, in May, if everything goes right, the InSight mission, and it's going to have a seismic detector, a seismometer on it that would detect impacts and airbursts. And so I'm very interested in the way airbursts couple to seismic waves and actually couple through the air as very low frequency infrasound that might be detected by this instrument. And if we can model this correctly, and if everything is successful, we can get an estimate of the impact flux, how many of these small objects are out there hitting Mars.
I think that's a cool place to leave it. We've been talking with physicist Mark Boslow. He's a technical advisor. He was a technical advisor for Sandia National Laboratories before retiring. And he's an advocate for planetary defense, as you've heard. You can find more links and more discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, it's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
With our ability to find events from many millions of years ago, it should be easy to say whether a comet hit the Earth just before humans developed agriculture and civilization. As you have heard, it is not easy, and scientists do not agree on the results. I spend a lot of time trying to resolve the truth about the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis. I did not succeed, but I did find lots of worthwhile things to explore. Some things not raised by either of our guests, so here you go from just a few of my notes. First, as Mark Boslow says, trust is everything in science. I checked out our guest Joanne Ballard. She went through the right training with very good advisors at the master's and doctorate level. Those advisors specialized in subjects helpful to the two new papers. Joanne is a genuine scientist. There's a long history and deep cultural fabric running below this whole topic, and sometimes it interferes. Humans have held a mythology or even religious belief that matter from space drives major events on Earth. Science agrees with a big asteroid ending the age of dinosaurs, hitting near Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula about 66 million years ago. The whole subject was popularized by a best-selling book published in 1950, which I read in the 1960s, Worlds in Collision by Emanuel Velikovsky. Then in 1979, the Scottish astronomer and author William M. Napier published with Victor Klube A Theory of Terrestrial Catastrophism. Bill Napier is a co-author in the current paper and provided some of the answers relating to astrophysics relayed to us by Joanne Ballard. Richard Firestone and Alan West joined the fray with her 2006 book, The Cycle of Cosmic Catastrophes, How a Stone Age Comet Changed the Course of World Culture. The science in that book has since been discounted. As you heard in our interviews, newer papers evolved in their theory of what happened. There is a group of people, mostly scientists, who are dedicated to proving comets continue to make big changes much more recently. They gather in two organizations, the Comet Research Group in the West and the Holocene Impact Working Group, which is based in Russia. Joanne Ballard and the other 29 authors of the new papers in the Journal of Geology belong to the Comet Research Group. The Comet Research Group was co-founded by Dr. Ted Bunch, who is a credible scientist, by George Howard, an enthusiast with no training in the field, and the enigmatic Dr. Alan West. Nobody, including science journalist Rex Dalton, has managed to find any proof of science degrees for Alan West, who took up that name only recently. I don't have a problem with citizen scientists and enthusiasts contributing good ideas and work, but we need honesty about that. By the way, I randomly checked three members listed on the website of the Comet Research Group. Dr. Sylvia Gonzalez replied she is a member, having seen evidence of a major event in her work in Mexico. Another said he is not a member per se, but has written two papers supporting the hypothesis. A third denied any connection to the group. During the interview, Mark Boslow mentioned a critical article by Rex Dalton. It's called Comet Theory Comes Crashing to Earth. It was published May 14, 2011. You can Google it or find a link in my show blog. We also mentioned the paper The Younger Dryas Impact Hypothesis, A Requiem, with lead author Nicholas Pinter. It was published June 20, 2011 in the journal Earth Science Reviews. The two new papers in the Journal of Geology, as I say, have about 29 authors. In my opinion, that's part of a growing disease in modern scientific literature. Science journals complain too many names are being given to add weight to a publication. There's a committee looking into that, and the abuses of adding names just to help careers with no indication of who did what work. I'm not saying that happened with these two papers in the Journal of Geology, but we have to recognize that a long list of co-authors no longer guarantees anything about whether the science is correct. I was surprised when two of the co-authors here were not scientists at all. The Comet Research Group is like a club of people with common interests in near-term impacts and coming impacts. Their Facebook page is a lively place to check out new arrivals from outer space and research into past contacts. Everything posted there seems to support the Younger Dryas impact theory with no criticism, but I found this Facebook page useful, and I'll be back. You can find a link to it in my show blog. The Comet Research Group is also a nonprofit in the United States. The main poster on their website is George Howard, a blogger at the Cosmic Tusk, the blogger at the Cosmic Tusk. The group is doing fundraising. They hope to get up to $100,000 or more to fund three expeditions to verify their impact theory. Over the past 3 months, they report getting around $35,000. For example, they would like to send members to find an impact crater, perhaps in Greenland or North Dakota. More worrying to me, the Comet Research Group is also sending out an expedition to Jordan to investigate whether a comet destroyed the biblical cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. It sounds like a marriage of mythology and religion, where comets determine human history. Of course, that is possible, but I worry about a cult-like following developing around this subject. Along those lines, the prolific author and amateur archaeologist Graham Hancock has endorsed the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis. Hancock claims there are many previous civilizations that were wiped out. This impact hypothesis, he says, explains what happened to them. His 2015 book, Magicians of the Gods, is based on the hypothesis. He gives credit to Kennett, Bunch, Alan West, and the gang. Graham has a page promoting the Comet Research Group on his popular website. Hanging around the fringes of the Comet Research Group are commenters who claim the pyramids and Stonehenge are all part of the human response to comet strikes. The scientists can't be blamed for such off-base comments. It's just part of the internet today. George Howard and his blog, The Cosmic Tusk, gets rave reviews from the world's worst climate denial blog, What's Up With That? Anthony Watts has run at least three pieces on the Younger Dryas impact event, and why not? It wasn't really climate change. A space rock did it. To be fair, Watts also reported on studies that refuted the hypothesis. As recently as February 2, 2018, Watts revived the story of massive fires and the comet strike during the time of early humans. So there is a continuing traffic between some supporters of this theory and climate change denial, but there is no climate denial in the scientific papers we're considering in this show. There is another small collection of scientists working on this comet theory. The Holocene Impact Working Group has six scientists who, quote, hypothesize that meteorite impacts on Earth are more common than according to current scientific consensus, end quote. Although the scientists involved come from all over the world, the group server is hosted in Novosibirsk, Russia, by the Tsunami Laboratory Institute, and that's part of the Siberian division of the Russian Academy of Sciences. That lab also maintains an expert database on Earth impact structures. Naturally, since global interest in the strike in Siberia in 1908, the largest in recent times, A cottage industry of scientists and tourists are fascinated by comets in Russia. Again, at the Holocene Impact Site, we find some books that cover alternative history. One example is Irishman Mike Bailey's 1999 book, Exodus to Arthur, Catastrophic Encounters with Comets. But I also note a Canadian book, Tsunami, The Underrated Hazard, by E. Bryant. Remember, our space expert Mark Boslow said that a tsunami arising from a comet landing in the ocean may be possible. More research is needed, but that could be a big surprise indeed. So where do we end up, and does it matter? I say all the issues around recognizing and measuring comet impacts matter a lot. The energy released from such events is measured in terms of comparable numbers of nuclear weapons exploded. Larger rocks from outer space have already changed Earth's climate and caused mass extinctions. Even the smaller ones can do significant damage, as Mark Boslow told us. Space rocks have passed close to Earth in the last few weeks. A big asteroid is expected to come very close to Earth in 2029. As Boslow said, if smaller ones come from the direction of the sun, we will not even see them before impact. So more science and raising awareness among the public is a positive thing. That's why I did this radio program. It is strange that we can have certainty about an event 66 million years ago, but no certain closure about a strike supposedly 12,800 years ago. NASA still reports the near-Earth object community of planetary scientists say that no large impacts have occurred during the past 15,000 years. As Nicholas Pinter points out, not a single human has been proven killed by a rock arriving from outer space. Statistically, it has been quiet on that front during our human times, but how long can that last? I've got a link to a paper about that in my show blog. So we need artists and even scientists to exercise imagination so our knowledge can progress. But we also have to be very cautious about what is science and what is myth-making. One of the pillars and promoters of the Unger-Dryas impact hypothesis is a leading light of science. Dr. James Kennett from the University of California, Santa Barbara, is legendary for his work. Still, as we have seen in the case of Dr. James Lovelock, scientists with vision can sometimes be very right about one thing and still wrong about another, and they may have the same passion for both. We are always going to be challenged about what is good science, and how do we keep our imaginative minds tracking with reality? Check out my weekly show blog for all the links and a new push to expand the reach of this show and its urgent message. That's at ecoshock.org. Thank you for taking this journey with me this week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This has been a kind of a wake-up call for the Canadian labor movement. It's not known for its excitement generally, but it has developed is going through a phase where it has to examine its conscience of what kind of movement it wishes to be. We're joined now, I believe, by Rick Hockley. Are you there, Rick?
Yes. Hello, Phil. Good evening.
Good evening. And Rick, you, of course, are an activist and member of Local 75 of Unite Here. Just to begin with, to ask the obvious, your union, Unite Here, has been in the news, and the name linked to it is Unifor, because Unifor did something very dramatic. They withdrew from the Canadian Labour Congress sort of on short notice, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And then after that, they announced that they are going to take in members of Unite Here. And the Unite Here, as I understand it, serves the hotel workers of Toronto.
Yeah, hospitality Toronto workers. Yeah.
Give us a background idea. Tell us about your union, first of all. I mean, Unite Here has how many members, and who does it represent?
Yeah, absolutely. So Unite Here, it's a hospitality workers union. So you'd referenced hotels, but we also represent food service workers and casino and gaming workers across North America. Mm-hmm. So I believe it's around 265,000 members strong that we have, the largest hospitality workers union in the world. Within our local of Toronto, we're about 7,500 members currently.
Mm-hmm. And this period, were you, surprised, or how did this come about that you find that you woke up one day? You must have been surprised at some stage that a union such as Unifor was announcing that they were going to attempt to win your members. By the way, the old-fashioned word for this is raid.
Raid, yes, yes. Well, it was the exact same day that they left the CLC. So, obviously it was premeditated from quite a while. I'm assuming at least the last couple of months that this is, been their plan, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
From our end, again, I was the former executive board member of our Local 75. I'd sat there for the past 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been through the day-to-day business and know how the union functions. And, this is something that definitely was a curveball for us. Mm-hmm. Wasn't expected at all. Again, in the spirit mm-hmm. of solidarity to kind of come in and raid another union, right?
So yes.
We're supposed to be,
Well, you belong to the Canadian Labour Congress, which has a constitution, it has
yeah.
bylaws, and it has methods of resolving disputes.
Absolutely. The dispute to resolve in regards to changing unions is actually called Article 4 mm-hmm. of the CLC Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that was never invoked by either party, either of Unite Here or of Unifor. When all this change came about, this is the first time that us within Unite Here was hearing of it as well. We were, hearing everything, through the media, essentially. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely a shock for us. Again, just in regards to, the fundamental principles of a union is, to fight injustice and discrimination and harassment in the workplace. And then you have, a union that should be kind of working together with yourself to raise up Canadian workers and their mm-hmm. families, and then they're kind of coming in to divide and mislead people.
Yeah. Let me ask, what was the reaction of the Canadian Labour Congress? I'll just tell you, frankly, myself, I was impressed. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't think they would get their act together so quickly and make such helpful statements. Give me your assessment of the Canadian Labour Congress.
You know what? We are so thankful and grateful for, all our sisters and brothers within the CLC and the Canadian Labour Movement. We've had such an outpouring of support from everyone, from unions from all over. It doesn't matter what kind of industry and whatnot. And I'm not a part of the CLC. I can't really speak for them directly, but I did have the privilege of going there just 2 weeks ago. I went to Ottawa for a meeting with all the leaders of the CLC.
Mm-hmm.
They had invited myself and two other colleagues of mine from Unite Here to speak to them and kind of basically go through what we're facing today in this battle of being raided.
Mm-hmm.
I sat right next to the president of the ATU, who is the, the ATU is the union that represents the Toronto transit workers, Local 113. And they had gone through the exact same thing 1 year prior to us, under this false flag narrative of an American invasion and whatever else they want to spin it. So it was interesting perspective to kind of hear from all these other people and industries that I wasn't aware of, that they had a similar story to us in regards to being raided, especially in regards to Unifort. Kind of seems to be practice of them to kind of come and pick up the pieces, so to speak, of of various locals and unions all over. So
We're speaking to Rick Hockley. He's an activist in Local 75 Unite here. And we ought to say, of course, too, you were put to the test. And as I understand it, 24 hotels were in a bargaining situation. And so they took a vote over who to represent them.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I was impressed, given the suddenness of the attack by a big union with deep pockets.
Deep pockets, for sure.
A lot of us thought, well, this is going to be ugly. But actually, it's an impressive outcome. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we weren't expecting that to happen, of all of our majority of our union staff to kind of leave the office and go to an opposing union, and being able to have that access to our members. In regards to having the personal contact in the workplace and at home. But of those 24 hotels that were attempted to be raided by Unifor, 17 of us, the hotels, stuck together with Unite here from the beginning. There were some votes in the remaining, five of which decided to leave us, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And then two hotels are still remaining. There's boxes that are sealed by the labor board currently.
Mm-hmm.
So we're expecting the results in about 2 to 3 weeks of those two hotels. And going forward, we're a union. We respect all the democratic voices of our members, and hopefully in time this is something that people will come to look back and see that it has only made us stronger as Unite here. To kind of go through this kind of internal battle and kind of rev up our members in regards to putting really what's at stake for ourselves and for our families, in regards to, our benefits and job security and our wages. A lot of workers, they spoke loud and clear that they didn't want to risk or jeopardize that, and that they stuck with Unite here, the Hospitality Workers Union.
Mm-hmm. This is Rick Hockley, and he's active in Unite here, and is also you're a banquet server in the Novotels, right?
Yes, yeah. I've, again, serving bartend for like the last 15 years, so just a normal rank and file Canadian worker. And again, I've been a part of involved within the union by becoming a shop steward and chief shop steward of my property, and then. Mm-hmm. Again, I was elected 2008 for the first term to become an executive board member to help run, the business of our union and make the bigger decisions, extraordinary expenditures and stuff. So,
yeah. Well, let me ask you, because it's striking to me that my understanding is that the president who went over to Unifor this is an issue, allegedly, of as told. The other narrative, the Unifor narrative, is, well, these are Americans who trample on the rights of the workers, et cetera, of Canada. But didn't this individual come from the United States? And she's not herself a rank and file person.
She's not Canadian either. She's American for sure.
That's a curious story they put together.
Well, again, this false narrative of patriotism and nationalism, it sells well in the media, but at the end of the day, this is something that was never discussed within our union, and no one ever had the problem of, having a president from the States. Again, we're an international union, right? Mm-hmm. These companies that we're up against, that we're fighting, you know, these global hotel corporations or, you know, billion-dollar conglomerates, you know, they don't have borders. They don't look at where you're from or, mm-hmm. you know, this sort of thing. So this is something that was never... Yeah. Never ever discussed with us, and it was never a problem, something that we never thought about. And again, in learning what happened previous with the ATU in Toronto last year, that was the same narrative. That the exact same. And again, that was something that the president was Bob Kinnear, and he lost, you know, I believe he lost the election in his vote to remain president, kind of threw a fit. And that was kind of what he ended up doing, was trying to go over to Unifor and just kind of steal his members. So, definitely not something that we look at. We don't, Unite here within Toronto, you know, one of the most diverse cities of the world. We have workers probably from, I believe, 80 or 90 countries. We come from all over the globe. We're majority workers of color, people like immigrants, people of color. Yes. And, you know, where you're from, it doesn't mean anything. It just adds to the strength and diversity of our union, and adds that kind of unique voice that we have.
Unite Here actually has a very progressive, the word progressive is raised once in a while to as a banner, and Unite Here has a progressive history and reputation. That must have served you well during this fight.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're a grassroots organization, right? Like, We're led by the workers. We, like myself as a worker, we are the leaders of the organization. You know, this doesn't come from the top down. We're not a corporation. You know, we have the ability to have a voice, to have a vote. And that's something that is, you know, maybe a little bit unique to us, sadly, when really it should be kind of like that all across unions and all across, you know, the world, you know. Workers' power, right? So we're all stronger together, and we're all kind of at the same thing.
Yeah. And let's talk about the issue that allegedly triggered all of this was the matter of trusteeship, and of course, everyone hears the word trusteeship, and that's an automatic worrying phenomena. But that every union has that capacity. It's an instrument that belongs to unions to salvage crisis situations. Am I right? I mean, and tell me, how did trusteeship come about, and why did that cause your previous leaders to decide they're going to jump overboard?
Again, it is in all unions, bylaws and constitutions, this provision of trusteeship to kind of have a last case, you know, scenario should we need to invoke such a thing. For our union, our local within Toronto, you know, this is something, again, that wasn't a brash, swift decision by our international. This is a long time coming. The executive board, we asked back in December of 2016 to invoke the trusteeship, because at that point, you know, our former president was just constantly making decisions unilaterally, not respecting the democratic voice of the governing body, which is the elected executive board members. Again, all rank and file members from within our hotels and food service that sit to govern our union. Mm-hmm. So that was something, again, from December of 2016 that we had reached out to our international, because by that point, nothing was getting done. The day-to-day functioning and operation of our union was being hindered. Yes. And it was all for
So the request was made by whom?
Our executive board. So our executive board consists of 25 working members, elected officers, that we have 25 plus, we have two trustees and three officers. So of the 30 of us, the majority is about 75% of us had asked for this trusteeship to kind of come in. And again, that was in December of 2016. We also had asked back, I believe, in April of 2017, and it wasn't invoked until this January of 2018. Mm-hmm. So again, our international...
Yeah, so it wasn't precipitous, and it wasn't decided at the big headquarters.
No, not at all. Again, this is something that ourself as the executive board had been asking and begging for a long time, because we saw really the day-to-day functioning of our local was just being spent on someone's personal motives and someone's personal gains versus the day-to-day business of bettering our members.
And that's why it's that instrument has to be occasionally employed.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this. We've also heard reports that some of the differences that got sharp and unpleasant in the fighting that caused the trusteeship to be brought into place involved issues of sexual harassment and racism. Is that true? Is there any content to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this all of this kind of conflict, it stems, you know, back in the fall of 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Progressively, it's been worse and worse. And then it came to this point where we were finally able to impose the trusteeship. It really shouldn't have come to that point, but it was clear that we had no other choice. And the international union
had
no choice.
You had members who complained that they were being racialized in their dealings with staff and or executive. Right?
Yeah, so it was, you know, there was a lot of racism structurally within our local office in regards to demotions, promotions, hiring people, you know, suspensions and that sort of thing. When a complaint or allegation was brought up, it wasn't investigated properly, depending on who was saying it. So there was even, you know, there was a lot of tolerance, but even kind of encouragement, if you look at it. And then obviously there was a lot of individual stories of racism where, you know, our leaders, our organizers who have really built our union, a lot of rank-and-file organizers who've come up to, you know, be a part of the labor movement and better workers' life the last, you know, couple of decades that have been there for a long time, they were being treated like criminals, you know, and a lot of people went on sick leaves with stress and just really upsetting things that it was just shocking because, again, for
when I hear this, I have to say it sounds to me like rather than leaving your union, they're fugitives from justice. I mean, you have to actually complete that investigation and there has to be determination if people were discriminated against, who did it, and some guarantee that they'll be protected in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, a lot of the complaints towards the people who had now left our organization, right? But they're still obviously our international is investigating those claims. And again, it's a process. It'll be a couple of months, I'm sure, further. But
the word trusteeship. And you tell me this story, I mean, that you had members who said that they were being treated in a racist way by people who should have been serving their best interests of the union.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to say to see clauses that those things will be immediately investigated, maybe not a trusteeship, but every union should arrive and say, hold it, somebody has said these things or there is an allegation. We want to get to the bottom of it, and we're not going to wait 3 months.
Again, I think there was just so much happening within our union. Again, it's mainly, you know, the division line racially was all, you know, the white people on one side, and then you have the people of color, mainly black and brown organizers on the other. And that really translated to, you know, the officers of our local down to the organizers, which then really went to the executive board and then through the hotels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, myself, I'm a white Caucasian male, but I sided on the side of justice, and it was on the side of the people of color, just how it happened to be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely something that we were pushing for a long time to, you know, deal with things in a swift manner and not let it get to such a point that it got to. Yeah. But again, legally and all that kind of.
You have to dot the I's and cross the T's.
Kind of, yeah, it's all kind of being done, you know, with lawyers and looking into, you know, different investigations, all that stuff. So that's kind of out of my hands, but definitely something that will be changing.
My impression is you could be very proud of Unite Here and the way it's handled all of this. And Rick Hockley, it's great that we could talk to you. I congratulate Unite Here 75 and, frankly, the Canadian Labor Congress comes through looking very good. I hope we can talk to you again, say, in a month or two, and kind of assess how this progresses.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we're very excited for the future, and we're just very thankful to have the opportunity to have our voice heard from you, Bill, and we'll definitely be around.
A lot of people in the labor movement have been waiting to hear Local 75 people talk, and you have done it. And Rick Hockley, thank you again very, very much. We look forward to talking to you.
My pleasure, Phil. Thank you so much for your time again.
Sure thing. Okay. Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And again, facebook.com/The Taylor Report and SoundCloud, Taylor-Report. We're going to take a musical break. We'll be back, and we're going to be talking to the author, Terry Watata, who happens to be a CIUT veteran.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Eric Milgram, a spokesperson with the Newtown, Connecticut Action Alliance, who discusses the potential of a new generation of gun safety activists to upend the status quo of inaction by Congress to strengthen the nation's gun laws. Sean Sweeney, coordinator of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, who explains why he believes that a transition to renewables is only possible if the world converts to publicly owned energy production. And former FCC Commissioner Michael Copps, who talks about the campaign to overturn the FCC's repeal of net neutrality rules through congressional action, lawsuits, and state legislation. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Well-funded right-wing groups, including the Koch brothers, are behind a high-profile Supreme Court case, Janus versus AFSCME Council 31, that could eliminate the collection of public sector union fees from non-union members. 2 years ago, key conservatives, including Grover Norquist and the American Legislative Exchange Council, known as ALEC, rallied behind a similar case, Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association. The plaintiffs, all teachers, objected to paying fair share fees as non-union members to cover the costs of collective bargaining. With a 4-4 split, the justices failed to rule in the case after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. The Janus case comes out of Illinois, where billionaire Republican Governor Bruce Rauner issued an executive order halting the collection of fair share union fees. Right-wing groups like the Influential State Policy Network and two of their member groups joined the suit. If the Janus verdict goes against public sector unions, an important question is who will step up to push for the renewal of the nation's trade unions. For without a strong labor movement, U.S. workers will find it extremely difficult to make progress in the struggle for economic and social justice. In its ongoing assault on immigration, the Trump administration is drafting new rules that would prevent immigrants from settling in the U.S. or receiving a green card if they or their family members have received benefits from a wide array of federal, state, and local social programs, even if the benefits were for an immigrant's U.S.-born child. According to the American Prospect, visa applications could be rejected if an immigrant's family applied for health insurance subsidies through the Affordable Care Act or enrolled their children in federal government programs like Head Start or CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. The new policies that Trump is proposing mean that immigrants who have received any public benefit to which they were legally entitled are likely to be turned away at points of entry to the U.S. or have their applications to extend their stays in the country denied. Immigrant rights advocates say the new restrictions are spreading fear in immigrant communities, where many will now avoid accessing prenatal care during pregnancy and drop health insurance for their children to avoid having visa applications rejected. Although the proposed rules will require a lengthy review process before it can take effect, immigration advocates are preparing to challenge the policy in court to further delay implementation. Former Save the Children chief executive Justin Forsythe resigned from a top post at the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, over complaints of inappropriate behavior toward female staffers. The BBC reports a number of incidents occurred at Save the Children in 2015 when Forsythe was accused of sending inappropriate text messages and comments on what young female staff were wearing. He said he apologized unreservedly to the three workers. In a statement, Forsythe insisted he did not resign as deputy executive director of UNICEF due to his actions at Save the Children, but rather to protect UNICEF and Save the Children from any further damage to their reputations as charitable groups. The resignation comes as another major aid group, Oxfam, is entangled in a scandal over revelations that Oxfam staffers in Haiti hosted parties with prostitutes in the aftermath of that nation's devastating 2010 earthquake. The Haitian government has since suspended Oxfam from providing aid on the Caribbean island. Since Forsythe's behavior came to light in 2015, Save the Children commissioned a root and branch review of its organizational culture and behavior of top executives. The Children's Aid Group fired 30 people in 2017 as a result of numerous misconduct investigations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After the latest mass shooting incident that killed 17 students and teachers at Parkland, Florida's Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School on February 14th, expectations were that interest in yet another tragic story of gun violence would soon fade from the headlines. But something is different this time. Student survivors of the Parkland school massacre refused to let their grief and trauma stop them from speaking out and becoming active in the campaign to rein in gun violence. Just days after the massacre, students and their supporters boldly confronted state and federal Republican politicians, challenging them to sever their ties with the NRA, return the pro-gun group's campaign contributions, and support new laws to better regulate who can buy a gun and restrict the sale of semi-automatic military-style assault rifles. In a White House meeting with the president, Parkland student survivors implored Mr. Trump to back stricter gun regulations. However, after offering some supportive rhetoric for banning bump stocks and to bolster background checks, days later there were indications that the president was backtracking on his initial modest support for increasing the minimum age to purchase some guns. Alternatively, the president supported a controversial NRA initiative to arm teachers in their classrooms. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Eric Milgram, a spokesperson with the Newtown Action Alliance, and father of two young daughters, who survived the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Here he comments on the inadequate responses from the president and Republican-controlled Congress, and the potential for a new generation of gun safety activists to upend the status quo of inaction by Congress to strengthen the nation's gun laws.
Every one of these is so painful for this town and probably for every other town that's been through this, because it reopens those old wounds every time. I can't say I'm surprised. I felt an immediate sadness. You know, it brings back a lot of the feelings, and I started thinking about the kids down there, what the families are going through, what the people who weren't killed but who were injured, you know, what they're going through. And so we didn't have really any survivors. Here in Sandy Hook, the victims were the children here were just too small, and it's just hard to fathom that we as a country could put men on the moon, but we can't solve this problem. And let's face it, there is a solution here. I'm tired of hearing all the gun nut rhetoric and, you know, the gun lobby talking points, which are tired, which are illogical. There's a counter for every one of them. They're stupid on their face anyway, but the data doesn't hold up either. So I've learned a lot about, you know, my first job out of graduate school was at the Centers for Disease Control. I worked in the toxicology group there. even then, I learned that that there was so much that, you know, we could have been doing, but the research was stopped. We couldn't, you know, pursue it because the NRA had cowed Congress. And so that's when I vowed, okay, I'm going to do everything within my power to, you know, make the knowledge available to people that we do have, to get to know the researchers in the field, but also to influence legislation so that we can collect the data that we need, that we can do the proper research, the analysis, and influence public policy from a place of evidence.
What's your response to President Trump and the NRA's proposal to arm teachers all across this country who are, quote-unquote, adept with a gun?
There is no answer to any problem that doesn't involve more guns to the NRA. That's their answer to every problem. I think that is the stupidest. Ask the teachers what they think, you know, because that is a really, really bad idea. Most days, most schools don't have mass shootings. You start putting all of these extra weapons into schools, you're going to have discharges due to people dropping it. A teacher lose their cool one day. Hey, it does happen. You're going to raise the risk. You're not going to impact mass shootings at all. Killers who decide to engage in a mass shooting, they don't care about, you know, if a target is armed or not. In fact, you hear this nonsense. You hear the president repeating, and the NRA started this, that mass shooters choose gun-free zones because they're soft targets. That's utter nonsense. They choose a place that is significant to them. Fort Hood, which had two major mass shootings within 2 or 3 years of each other, was not a gun-free zone. In Europe, mass shooters there, you know where they usually go? By far, the number one target for them? Military installations. Why is that? You know, why, if you're a mass shooter in Europe, would you go to the one place where you're going to likely encounter guns? It's utter nonsense. It's irresponsible. And you know what? The NRA is doing their job, though. It would increase gun sales. And for all of these quote-unquote patriots out there who said they need to be armed because of a tyrannical government, but at the same time, they're supporting the creation of 100,000 or so new government employees that are armed, it's utterly stupid.
Dr. Milgram, what do you make of the students from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School who've been so articulate, so poised, so well-versed in the facts about this debate? Are you optimistic that these students can break through and make some changes where so many others have failed over the last several decades?
I'm very optimistic. The kids are all right. You know, from what I see, the NRA and the gun trolls who love to align themselves with the NRA, they picked the wrong fight. These kids are social media savvy. They are emboldened. They are not backing down. I personally tried for years to get Enterprise, Avis. I used to travel extensively. You know, I do a lot of miles every year on airlines and rental cars and hotels. And when I learned that the rental car companies gave NRA members a discount, I was furious about it, you know, because of what happened here in Sandy Hook and what my kids had to go through. So I personally wrote letters. Nothing. They ignored me. I tweeted at them. They ignored me. These kids, in less than a week, they've been able to get a large number of companies, including the major airlines, including the major rental car companies, to sever their relationships with the NRA. I will only support businesses whose values are aligned with mine. And I would say, you know, to the kids in Florida, you keep it up. You've already had more impact in 1 week than all of the gun violence prevention groups and gun control groups have done over the last 30 years.
That was Dr. Eric Milgram, a spokesperson with the Newtown Action Alliance and father of two young daughters who survived the 2012 Sandy Hook, Connecticut elementary school shooting. Learn more about the campaign to enact common sense gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On February 24th, a group of Connecticut-based climate activist organizations sponsored a conference titled A Teach-In for a Livable World, Climate Justice Now. One of the speakers at the West Hartford gathering was Sean Sweeney, coordinator of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, a global organization that promotes publicly owned renewable energy resources. Sweeney began his presentation by maintaining that many climate scientists, NGOs, and trade unions have bought into the conventional wisdom that a transition of renewables is inevitable, especially after British climate negotiator Nicholas Stern popularized the idea that individuals and businesses must pay to pollute, and that paying more for dirty energy will inevitably reduce greenhouse gases. Here, Sweeney discusses why such an outcome has not materialized in the 20 years since the Rio Climate Summit, and why he believes a transition to renewables is not inevitable going forward, unless the world converts to public ownership of energy production. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded Sweeney's talk and presents the following excerpts.
The labor movement was attending these climate talks very much in a small minority. It's not a top priority. It wasn't then and it isn't now for the labor movement, who are struggling to survive, not just in this country, but elsewhere. But they took the view, and I think they should be acknowledged for their role in this, that the science was important. There was no negotiating with these emissions reduction trajectories, that this was necessary. And what workers needed to do, or workers' representatives, was to make sure that workers didn't actually get thrown under the bus by these reductions. If there were going to be reductions in emissions, that's going to affect energy-intensive industries, and that will mean workers will lose their jobs. So the emphasis was on just transition, a term that grew up in the U.S. trade union movement with the oil, chemical, and atomic workers under the leadership of the late Tony Mazzocchi back in the 1980s. So just transition was the demand, and on top of that was green jobs, because if we needed a low-carbon future and these aggressive science targets were necessary, that's going to create tens of millions of jobs around the world. So we want those jobs, and we want them to be good jobs. So these were the basic demands. But it never challenged the idea that the transition itself was inevitable. In fact, many union leaders said, this is going to happen, we have to be prepared for the future, etc., etc. Let's go to 2009 and the Copenhagen Accord. The United States, with a number of other countries, decided that a legally binding agreement on emissions reductions was not necessary. This was the Obama administration, not the Trump administration. Obama said that every country should put on the table a pledge, what they think they can do, and then we will review that pledge against the science. And so the Copenhagen Accord changed the whole legal architecture of the global climate talks to one which was a pledge and review voluntary agreement. So this set is the stage for the rather important moment in trade union history, in my view, which was in 2012, was the 20th anniversary of the Rio Summit, the Earth Summit of 1992. In 2012, it was again in Rio, and there was a big conference hall of unions, just unions, saying, What are our demands at this Earth Summit? And the issue of climate change and the green economy came up, of course, was the main focus of this of the trade union assembly. And something very significant happened there. I was privileged enough to be in the room. The United Nations Environment Programme, the various agencies, the World Bank, got up and addressed this trade union audience and said, the transition to a low-carbon economy is inevitable. And all we need to do is make sure that we are trying to have a just transition and we can leave it to market forces to address this problem called climate change. The reaction was very, very angry from the group. These were mostly unions from Latin America, but there were also very many representatives from unions from around the world. And they said, you've got to be kidding me. Essentially, the International Energy Agency has said that from 1990 to 2012, that emissions had gone up 61%. Now, think of that in historical terms. We're talking about a brief moment in history, 20 or so years, and emissions going up 61%. That was 2012. Since then, they've continued to rise. They've slowed down a little bit, but they've gone up again this year. So emissions keep going up. So where is this transition to a low-carbon economy? The unions also said, everywhere we go, particularly in the global south, extractionism is running rampant. Fracking, drilling, mining, mountaintop removal. Basically, extrajudiciary killing, assassinations of environmental and trade union leaders who oppose this agenda. So there was a resolution was developed on the floor that said that there needed to be a reclaiming and defense of the commons. that the market could not produce a sustainable economy or a sustainable ecological situation, and that we had to reclaim to the public what had been privatized, particularly in the energy sectors. And extractionism had to stop. There's no point saying that, you know, we can just sort of have a few incentives and market signals to get ourselves out of this. Meanwhile, of course, the carbon price that Nicholas Stern said was going to be introduced was tried in Europe. And it was supposed to be in place now globally at the level of around about $100 a ton. In the ensuing 12 years, only 13% of global emissions are priced. When we look at interrogate the economics of renewable power, what we see is this. The single most expensive part of it is the borrowing of capital. We need to lower the cost of capital. How do we do that? The best thing to do is not have private companies do it. Have public renewable energy companies established.
That was Sean Sweeney, coordinator of Trade Unions for Energy Democracy and director of the International Program on Labor, Climate, and Environment at the Murphy Institute, City University of New York. The preceding talk was recorded at a February 24th teach-in sponsored chiefly by 350.org Connecticut and the Connecticut chapter of the Sierra Club. Learn more about the movement promoting publicly owned renewable energy resources by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Republican majority on the Federal Communications Commission voted to repeal the nation's net neutrality rules on December 14th last year. Those regulations, which had been on the books since 2015, prevented internet service providers like AT&T, Comcast, and Verizon from engaging in censorship or controlling the speed at which consumers access specific websites, apps, and other online services. The absence of net neutrality rules now allow broadband providers to charge customers additional fees to gain faster access to specific websites or content, much like cable television. The FCC's vote to repeal net neutrality was published in the Federal Register on February 22nd, which begins a 60 legislative day period where Congress has the power to invoke the Congressional Review Act, where a majority vote in the House and Senate can overturn a federal agency's policy change. A national coalition of more than 200 groups and companies supporting a free internet launched Operation One More Vote on February 27th, organizing a flood of calls, emails, and tweets to legislators with the goal of securing one more vote needed in the Senate to overturn the FCC's repeal of net neutrality. Your reporter spoke with Michael Copps, a former FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, who now serves as a special advisor to Common Cause and their Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. Here, Commissioner Copps discusses the importance of net neutrality and the campaign to restore it through congressional action, lawsuits, and state legislative initiatives.
50 senators have signed up in support of passing a resolution of disapproval authorizing this Congressional Review Act. We need 51 to pass the Senate. You know, everything in this town is so partisan. But we have Senator Collins, who's a Republican from Maine, and she's joined most of the Democrats. So we're at 50, but we're having a devil of a time trying to find the 51st senator to cast that vote. And, you know, you could say, well, if it passes the Senate, that's fine, but it has to pass the House, and that's true, and that would be maybe an even steeper climb, and then to really put it into effect, the President has to sign it. That's rolling the big rock up the hill, too, but I think this is a fight worth having, and it's certainly a fight worth winning in the Senate, but it draws the people's attention and the media's attention a little bit to what's at stake here, and that this is an ongoing battle that is being fought on the congressional front through this resolution of disapproval, and that it'll be fought in the courts through a lot of suits that will be presented. A lot of jurisprudence is ahead of us. And in the final analysis, it will be fought in the court of public opinion. And I think it's very important that when people cast their votes next time, that they be aware of this issue and the importance of communications and of trying to get a media ecosystem that really serves the needs of the country. You know, the internet is so important. So much of our political activity is taking place right now, and if people aren't free to go where they want to go or to use that as a tool for organizing, if they have to always be afraid of gatekeepers, Comcast or AT&T or Verizon or one of these companies is going to, you know, maybe they're going to interfere with this viewpoint, another viewpoint that they don't happen to agree with. We've had some history of that already in the past, even when we had people thinking that net neutrality was probably going to be here to stay. And now if we repeal the rules, that's just flashing a green light to all these companies to use the internet for their own purposes and their own profitability. The tragedy is this, and it's a tragedy of history. Here you have this open, dynamic technology, probably more dynamic and important than anything since the printing press, to really expand our news and our information, to expand our democracy, to better inform the people. And are we just now going to just say, okay, we're just going to turn this over to the big companies? Are we going to just cableize the internet? That's really what it is, you know. And who wants a cableized internet? Who likes paying all those cable bills and as they go up and up and up? Net neutrality is not a guarantor of a truly open internet, but it's a prerequisite. It's a condition of an open internet.
Michael Copps, I wanted to ask you, beyond congressional action that we just talked about, there are lawsuits that are being planned to prevent the final repeal of net neutrality. And a fascinating approach is also starting to take root, and that is state legislation that would really anchor the ISPs around the country to state regulations that would continue the protections of net neutrality.
Well, several governors, Montana, New York, a few others, have already used their executive powers and using their power to contract for services from the telecommunications companies and passing executive orders saying, if you want the state's business on telecommunications, you have to abide by the net neutrality process. And I think they have the power to do that. This is something that's going to be fought out in the courts, too. The new FCC under Chairman Pai is saying, oh, no, we can preempt everything. You know, this is all federal. Some of the states are going in this direction. And then there are, I think, something like 22 state attorneys general going to be on a lawsuit to go beyond that on net neutrality, too. So, yes, so once you get outside this beltway, it's not a partisan issue.
That was Michael Copps, a former FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, who now serves as a special advisor to Common Cause in their Media and Democracy Reform Initiative. Learn more about the campaign to restore net neutrality by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, WRFP in Moscow, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
For as sort of a preamble to the questions, I have a 29-year-old son and a 13-year-old daughter who's the one that really rides my bumper. And she says to me a lot, since she's an artist, Mom, does it all have to be so grim? You know, where are the people feeling good about things or the change? And sometimes, you know, we deal with very grim realities. And sometimes that takes over. So my preamble is, can we include joy, humor, wit, and your música that I hear sometimes coming through you?
We can. Of course we can. But the problem, of course, is that art especially is...
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Art, especially as taught to many of us here in this culture, is a commodity. When you turn on the TV or listen to the radio, and often when you open a newspaper, I mean, there are plenty things to laugh about, plenty things to kind of entertain you and to make you happy. And that's the kick. I mean, what you'll see is plenty of everything but truth. And the truth is often a harsh, painful thing, especially when you're talking about the histories of peoples in this country. And it's almost like, Mama, tell me about Santa Claus. That's essentially what they're given, as opposed to the truth about how this country came to be, you know, who was stolen to work this country and whose country it was stolen from.
Correct.
Those are things that especially kids need to know, because if they don't learn that as kids, it's very, very difficult to break through when they're adults. You know, we put masks over our face and wax in our ears because we don't want to hear it.
I agree. Well, I think probably my kids get a larger share of the reality of slavery and colonialization than most children. So, because I feel that's such a central part of their education, and we can't really talk about, we can't really set the context without that.
Or else you're telling them fairy tales.
That's
you know,
right.
You can do that. But there are many kids, for example, who, as young adults or teenagers, when they do find out about what this country's true history is or the history of African-American resistance in this country, it floors them. I mean, it slays them. And they come out enraged that their teachers, their parents, their elders did not tell them these truths.
That's right. Why didn't I know?
Why didn't I know this?
That's right.
You know.
That's right. So, in the light of all that, if you, Mumia, were able to be here with me making the drawing, which I'm hoping to make within the next couple of weeks to begin the drawing, I draw quickly and intensely. What ideas would you want expressed in this piece that's going to communicate to the world the issues that you're dealing with? Political prisoners, particularly in this country, etc. What would you want the central focus of this piece to be?
Well, when I thought about it, I thought about, oddly enough, architecture, which isn't, of course, your field. But I recognize that architecture reflects the power of the princes and not the visions of real builders, real people.
Not allowed during this conversation. Have a collect call form.
Mumia Abu-Jabal.
Verizon Select Services Incorporated.
Go ahead with your call.
Hello, Mumia.
Juana.
Ah, the power of princes.
Yeah.
Instead of...
I should say the greed of princes when they want more money off the phone.
Yeah.
But back to my thought, architecture, it reflects the power of princes and not the visions of real builders, who are, of course, the people. So murals should reflect the counterpoint. Make the invisible visible. You know, those who tend to be those who are most invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say generally make the invisible visible,
mm-hmm.
not just for the moment, but for days, years, and ages to come, especially mm-hmm. for the young people we talked
mm-hmm.
about earlier.
Mm-hmm. In that, I guess knowing that they're making us cut to the chase here, let me ask you what invisible icons that are closest to your heart, cultural symbols, or your own iconography. I believe what you're saying, that the mural is the skin of the organism that functions below the skin.
Absolutely.
So
it should be.
Yes, well, that's what I try to do with it. So what from the inside of the organism would you want to make visible?
Well, I think of images of rebels like Huey P. Newton, the founder of the Black Panther
mm-hmm.
Party, especially, you know,
mm-hmm.
the poster that we all had in our homes of
mm-hmm.
him and his
in the chair. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, images of the life of resistance, images that I'm thinking of the image of people like John Africa walking
mm-hmm.
out of a federal courtroom smiling.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
The imagined images of Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman, Pancho Villa, engaged in the hard work of freedom fighting, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as we would have seen.
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
As we see them in our imagination.
That's
yes,
right.
Yes, we're
that's important
living those moments.
When we do that, we pass them on. I mean, they,
mm-hmm.
you know, in African culture, it was said that as long as you remember someone, they're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
They really are.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that's the case in many, you know, natural oriented cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
remember those people who fought for freedom.
So in terms of a quote, that would be a beautiful organizing principle.
Absolutely.
Do you have some particular quote that you want me to include? Because I always try to include the literary or the poetic in some way. Even if it's only symbolic, but if it's literal, even better.
Well, I mean, you're free, of course, to use what I said, because mm-hmm. I thought about it for a few days, but I don't have any real quote in my head. Your art is image, not words.
Mm-hmm.
And if the images are evocative enough, believe
mm-hmm.
me,
mm-hmm.
if they awaken people enough, they inspire people enough,
mm-hmm.
the words will follow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe that. Well, I love that idea about keeping the spirit alive with the story. You gave me a list already with Harriet and Pancho and the whole dream team.
Right.
But I almost want to let you just sort of free associate right now, because I think you covered very eloquently and quickly on my whole question list here.
Well, here's one that I hadn't said, and I thought about it.
Not allowed during this conversation. Go ahead with your call.
Yes, well.
You're getting rich today, huh?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I hate this. I tell
yes,
you what.
I'm sorry they can't take the evocative images
in
word and voice. But I had an idea before we got cut off, and it
came to me actually earlier today when I was thinking about it, and I said, I would do Geronimo. Then I said, whoa, both Geronimos.
Uh-huh.
You know,
I love
Geronimo,
that.
Geronimo, the Chiricahua
yes.
resistance fighter.
Geronimo.
And Geronimo Gijaga,
yes.
the former Black
Panther
Gijaga
Pratt, yes, oh yes.
So, you know, I mean, think about what that teaches people,
mm-hmm.
this resistance over this, you know, century of time. And
well, and I love the alliance, too, between
absolutely.
The struggles and our and the quote-unquote races that we have.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It shows how little things have changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that a man born in Louisiana, an African-American, would be proud to take that name
mm-hmm.
and carry that name and remake
the name, yes. Beautiful.
Yeah. I think those images can teach young people,
mm-hmm.
you know, about the continuation of struggle,
mm-hmm.
you know, in various fronts
mm-hmm.
of various people, but, you know, essentially against the same enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings me to sort of more of the symbolic level, as I think we have a pretty fluid vocabulary between us about the historical people,
mm-hmm.
and that is sort of like maybe you saw from some of the images that I often use, like a red star or a chain or a DNA. Yes, butterflies. Yes, the butterfly in Erie, Pennsylvania. Do you have some organic or visceral or
visual images that you would
this
want?
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Well, in my own head, I see what I rarely see with my eyes, which is green.
Mm.
You know, and I'm not talking about particular flower. I'm talking about something as common but as beautiful, mm-hmm. as inspiring as grass.
Mm-hmm. Like Lorca said, verde, que te quiero verde.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And green life.
Mm-hmm. Green
you
life.
Know, because, yeah. you know, that was the life that was here before us. That's the life that sustains us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm an herbalist, so I understand
mm-hmm.
how important that is for healing people.
Mm-hmm. Any particular herbs that you...
Absolutely. Golden seal.
Mm-hmm.
Echinacea. You know.
I just did this mural, which is 100 tiles long. Part of it, it's 1,000 tiles on diversity and healing, and there's garlic and echinacea.
There you go.
And I didn't do golden seal, I did digitalis and the om and the olin symbol, the butterfly for movement. Anyway, but I love that. So the golden seal.
But think about how, you know, we need to reconnect with that to heal, because believe me, the drug companies ain't going to heal. Especially poor folks who can't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, herbs are going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Oh, I love that. Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. What else? What else can we pack in here that you would want?
The most important thing, and I know you know this because you opened up with it, is how do we connect with young people? And that means kind of incorporating some images that can touch.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
That they can hear, that'll have meaning for them.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you want to think about something like Public Enemy, you know,
mm-hmm.
even though they're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Sure, yeah.
Because young people will recognize what that means.
Mm-hmm.
We have to get them. I mean, if
right.
you do it your way and I do it my way,
mm-hmm.
you know, we might get them one way or the other.
Oh, I love that. And I, you know, if you want to send me a drawing of any kind, I realize you're a visual artist, and I saw the beautiful piece that you did, Guapale. I actually painted her a few years ago, too. So that's lovely. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, thank you.
So, anything
you have 15 seconds left to talk.
I ain't no muralist. I work with little, you know, card sizes. But,
it's what we have at hand. That's right. Well, much love, Omia. Much love. I really appreciate this. And
thank
I will
you,
send
Anna.
You
I
drawings.
You.
Okay. Mucho gusto.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
How unified are the citizens of South Korea behind their president and unity talks with North Korea? What would be the consequences of Korean unification for U.S. force presence and economic clout in the region? What role is Japan playing in the North-South dialogue? How did the recent Olympic Games play into the hands of certain elites and negatively impact Korean communities and the environment? Was the warning of a ballistic missile heading for Hawaii last January a psyop? And if so, who were the orchestrators and the beneficiaries? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we get an update on the Korean crisis in the wake of the Olympics, the North-South dialogue, and the January missile scare over Hawaii. Our guests are Professor Michelle Chosadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization, academic and former Olympic athlete Professor Jules Boykoff, investigative journalist Sherry Kane, and media intelligence analyst and investigator Leonard Horowitz. On this week's program, Olympic debts, phony threats, and post-colonial regrets. What does the future hold for Korea? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 2nd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, Global globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Trying to imagine the number of attacks carried out without interruption for 12 hours, we came to the conclusion that Idlib Governorate, in the view of The Guardian, has suffered a saturation bombing. In fact, if these figures were accurate, at least 8 aircraft would have flown mission and dropped about 60 bombs at every town, based on an average maximum loading of 8 FAB-500 general-purpose bombs per one Su-25 jet. At the same time, Business Insider reports that, quote, the most recent satellite images of the Russian-operated Maimum airbase in Syria show Moscow has 10 types of aircraft in the war-torn country, 33 jets in total, and a smaller number of fixed-wing aircraft, unquote. So, all the Russian aircraft are supposed to have taken off and landed 4 times, refueled, loaded weapons, and once again set course for Idlib for the 12 hours. If it really did happen, this military operation could be compared to the one-night air raid on London during WW2, which caused over 500 deaths a night. That comes from the article, Mainstream Media Disinformation on Syria, posted February 28th, originally appearing at Inside Syria Media Center. Very few corporate journalists have been on the ground in Syria. Paradoxically, those who have are effectively embedded in areas dominated by al-Qaeda-type groups, which Western governments are supporting directly and through Gulf intermediaries. Most of these journalists are relying on information provided by Western governments or from groups with strong vested interests in Assad's overthrow. Should we take this media coverage on trust, as many of us did the lies promoted about Iraq and later Libya by the same Western governments and corporate media? Or should we be far more wary this time, especially as those earlier regime change operations spread more chaos, suffering, and weapons across the Middle East and fueled a migrant crisis now empowering the far right across much of Europe? That comes from the article, The Authoritarians Who Silence Syria Questions, by Jonathan Cook, posted February 28th, originally appearing at the Jonathan Cook blog. According to the Times of London, quote, Carla Del Ponte, head of the independent UN commission investigating reports of chemical weapons use in Syria, told a Swiss-Italian television station that UN investigators gleaned testimony from victims of Syria's civil war and medical staff which indicated that rebel forces used sarin gas, a deadly nerve agent. Quote, our investigators have been in neighboring countries interviewing victims, doctors, and field hospitals, and according to their report of last week, which I have seen, there are strong concrete suspicions but not yet incontrovertible proof of the use of sarin gas from the way the victims were treated, Del Ponte said in the interview, translated by Reuters. This was use on the part of the opposition, the rebels, not by the government authorities, she added, unquote. It was the involvement of those jihadis posing as Syrian rebels that made then-candidate Trump state emphatically that he wouldn't intervene and help oust Assad as Hillary Clinton wanted to do. That comes from the article, Video, No Chemical Weapons Used by Assad in Syria? Reality Check, by Ben Swan, posted February 28th, originally appearing at Truth in Media. The potentially corrupting influence of money has become more and more dominant in U.S. politics, and it has been openly encouraged by numerous decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, especially as we have seen by the Roberts U.S. Supreme Court, in favor of the wealthy, the powerful, and private interest groups, and against the common good. As a consequence, popular trust in the U.S. government has declined steadily over the last half century. According to the Pew Research Center, while 73% of Americans were said to have trust in the federal government in Washington, D.C. in 1958, that percentage had fallen to a mere 18% in 2017. This represents a huge erosion of public trust in government in a bit less than 60 years. This is a generational shift of great magnitude and the sign of a profound disgust. That comes from the article, "For All Practical Purposes, the American System of Government is Failing. How and Why?" by Professor Rodrigue Tremblay, posted February 28th, originally appearing at thenewamericanempire.com. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Well, the 2018 Olympics are over. Much of the media took note of the two Koreas competing as a united team. Meanwhile, U.S. belligerence seemed to continue unabated, as is witnessed by Vice President Mike Pence's less than diplomatic gestures during the Games. There seem to have been significant diplomatic breakthroughs during this period between the two Koreas, with the North-South talks seeming to place South Korea at odds with the U.S. and Japan. What are the prospects for peace on the Korean Peninsula in the face of these events? Well, joining us to discuss this question is none other than Professor Michel Chosudovsky. Professor Chosudovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics, emeritus at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, and editor of Global Research. He spoke in front of the Korean Parliament last week and participated in events alongside other anti-war, labor, political, other voices. He joins us now from Cebu in the Philippines. Good morning, Professor Chosudovsky.
Good morning. Good morning. Indeed, I spent a full week in the Republic of Korea. The meeting at the Parliament building was, in fact, more a discussion group of non-governmental organizations, politicians, academics, and a very fruitful discussion in which I presented a procedure which would lead to the so-called demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula. Because at this stage, under the Combined Forces Command agreement between the United States and the Republic of Korea, all Republic of Korea troops and forces, including 600,000 forces plus reserves, will automatically go under the command of a general appointed by the Pentagon. That is something which is embedded and which in effect prevents the progress of the so-called inter-Korean dialogue between North and South, because any kind of U.S. military threat or aggression directed against North Korea would automatically harness the Republic of Korea armed forces. And in other words, the preamble to any kind of meaningful peace negotiations would require the repeal of this agreement.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of what you were, when you speaking with all of these other groups, I imagine there was a solid understanding that the United States and their role in this is not so much to advance the prospects for the South Korean people as to maintain their own force presence there, maintain their own grip on the country.
Well, there's certainly an understanding of U.S. Objectives to prevail in the Republic of Korea in terms of its occupation forces, 28,000 troops, its military cooperation agreements, and so on. But I must say that public opinion in South Korea is heavily divided, and it's only recently with the inter-Korean dialogue that there's a shift, because if you ask people in the street, well, what do you think of the United States? Well, they'll say, well, the United States is our ally, they're our friends, they're helping us and guaranteeing our security. So there is a there's evidently this propaganda, both emanating from the successive governments as well as from the South Korean media, that ultimately North Korea is a threat to their security. And but that perception is changing, and there are powerful voices within South Korea, particularly within the government of President Moon, which understands that, in fact, the United States is intent upon undermining the North-South dialogue. In fact, Washington is even threatening South Korea with sanctions for having pursued dialogue with North Korean officials. And, of course, we saw what happened with Mike Pence. At the same time, and I think that's very important, is that coinciding with the Olympic Games and the announcement of the inter-Korean dialogue, Washington has come up with this so-called bloody nose option of attacking North Korea, either with conventional or so-called low-yield tactical nuclear weapons, which inevitably would lead to escalation. It's, you know, bloody nose is a military concept, which ultimately is based on the understanding that a tactical nuclear weapon is harmless to civilians. You just get a bloody nose and there's minimal amount of collateral damage. But that is also what I'd call a bloody lie rather than a bloody nose. It's these tactical nuclear weapons have an explosive capacity going between one-third and 12 times a Hiroshima bomb. And consequently, the use of a tactical nuclear bomb, a more usable, as defined in the Nuclear Postural Review, which inevitably lead to warfare on a large scale. So we discussed some of these concepts. The negotiation procedures between North and South are somewhat, I mean, there are certain things on which the public is informed, what's going on. But in fact, the intelligence agencies are also involved. The U.S. intelligence is in touch with their counterparts in the Republic of Korea, the so-called KCIA. And in turn, the intelligence community in South Korea is in touch with North Korea, so that there's still a certain dialogue taking place, both at the official level, but also what, of course, is occurring is unannounced contacts and discussions. But at the same time, I think we must understand that we are at a very dangerous crossroads. Foreign policy miscalculation on the part of the United States could lead to the unthinkable, a nuclear war, which could eventually evolve towards a third world war. And mistakes are often what determine the course of world history.
Professor Chossudovsky, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, the president, Moon Jae-in, he seems to be really championing this denuclearization, and he seems to be much more at odds, you would think, with the U.S. Strategic aims. And, of course, I mean, he's fully supportive of this North-South initiative. Of course, that's coming after this the impeachment. Like he came into power after the previous president, who had extended the CFC that you mentioned, this Combined Forces Command, to 2025, I think it was, and so we have this new this different kind of leader. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about his personal popularity and whether there's any. You know, the fact that he seems to be championing these sorts of initiatives of peace and North-South
Unity talks, if that is to his benefit or detriment as far as the public is concerned?
Well, you know, he's an extremely careful diplomat. He has championed the issue of repeal of North Korea's nuclear weapons. But at the same time, he's having discussions with the North, and what is on the drawing board now is a summit to be held in Pyongyang at some future date, a meeting between the two leaders. There are important delegations going back and forth, and there's for the first time in several years there's actual contact and debate and discussion and concern. And also, I would say that the notion that there's only one Korean nation, that is something which is gaining impetus in the Republic of Korea. And because there's only one Korean nation, the issue of the Combined Forces Command, which puts South Korean armed forces under the command of a U.S. general. This is also a very important dimension. People realize that ultimately the Republic of Korea has to remain sovereign. But I think that President Moon is a very smooth operator. He does not necessarily reveal everything. He is maintaining a dialogue with the United States. He is very much also taking into account that his government is divided. People in the military on the one hand and in intelligence. There's a situation of conflict within the South Korean government, and he is attempting to reconcile conflicting allegiances, and the fact that the whole Korean decision-making apparatus is permeated with U.S. military advisors. So that is something to bear in mind.
I know in the past we've discussed that United States has motives that really are not so much concerned about the nuclear capacity of North Korea so much as the fact that a united Korea would be a major economic an industrial powerhouse, as well as the fact that it borders both Russia and China. So my understanding then is that there would be no unification without some strings, like we got to maintain a U.S. force presence. Based on what you're hearing from other people that you've been working with in the anti-war human rights organizations in South Korea, is there any sense that a united Korea would allow for a continued U.S. force presence, or would we be looking at U.S. forces being evicted from the peninsula?
Well, certainly the United States actually back in the year 2000 in the project for the New American Century had already intimated what would be a plan B. It would consist in actually stationing U.S. forces in North Korea. So their first objective is to hinder the process of reunification. But if that is not possible, they would want for the United States to impose the terms of that reunification and station troops in North Korea. That won't happen. That won't happen. And I think the other dimension that you raise is the fact that, first of all, yes, a united Korean nation would be a country of 80 million people with scientific, technological, economic, industrial, as well as military capabilities. And indeed, it would become de facto a regional power in Northeast Asia. That's certainly understandable. On the other hand, it should be noted that, in effect, North Korea is considered by the United States as a buffer state, because the real target of U.S. global warfare is ultimately Russia and China, and it's not North Korea. And what the United States wants to do is to ensure its hegemony, its geopolitical hegemony in Northeast Asia against China and Russia. I should mention that the position of China is somewhat ambiguous, because China has sided with the U.S. in many regards, despite their differences. I should also mention, that's very important, is that the THAAD missiles, which are stationed on the Korean Peninsula, are ultimately intended for China, not for the DPRK. And then you have this process of militarization of the Korean Peninsula. Ultimately, it is part of a broader agenda of encirclement of the People's Republic of China, the militarization of both the North and South China Sea, the militarization of the Korean Peninsula, the stationing of U.S. facilities in different parts of Asia, and the militarization of the waterways. So that, in effect, there's a double agenda. There's an agenda directed against the Korean nation on the one hand, but there's also the broader agenda against the great powers, which are targeted by the United States, namely Russia and China. And I would say probably more at this juncture, more Russia than China, in view of the fact that concurrently there's a process of militarization of Eastern Europe, the Baltic states, and the Balkans, directed against the Russian Federation.
I was wondering if you could comment on the role of Japan in this whole situation, because I know that Japan has been very closely aligned with the United States, and they've been as intense in their condemnation of the North Koreans as the U.S., so, you know, Shinzo Abe. So how have you seen Japan, their involvement, their interference with this North-South initiative, if any?
I think that the Japanese government views the North-South inter-Korean dialogue as a threat to their own hegemonic role in Northeast Asia. Mm. The fact that Japan is, it's a former imperial power, but it's still there exercising a role at a regional level, and it is a firm ally of the United States. And what is occurring is a geopolitical shift, which in some regards is characterized by the possible reunification of the two Koreas, but also an expanded role of China and Russia in the region. The reunification of Korea would not only weaken the United States in East Asia, it would also weaken Japan. There's no question about that. And then we have to address the bilateral relationship between the United States and Japan, which is a former colonial power, which has played a historical role in Korea. And bear in mind that all what is unfolding now is a whole series of military cooperation agreements, including in the European Union, where the command structures, the national command structures, are being put in the hands of the United States or NATO. There's a big debate in Italy at this moment, because the Italian government, in advance of the elections, has actually signed an agreement with NATO, which puts the entire Italian forces under the command of NATO, which essentially means under the command of the United States. And so the situation I described with regard to South Korea's links to the United States and the fact that ROK forces are under U.S. command is happening in other countries. And all the member states of NATO, in fact, most of them now, are virtually de facto obeying orders which come from the Pentagon via NATO. And that leads to a situation where the individual nation states are not even in a position to veto a war which is led by the United States, but uses the military forces of U.S. allies to do the dirty work, so to speak. So it's a very, very dangerous situation. What is unfolding in North Korea could potentially lead to a third world war. Although at this particular juncture, I would think that if these tactical nuclear weapons were to be tested, they would be first tested in the Middle East in the context of U.S. threats directed against now both Lebanon and Iran.
Okay.
The Israel playing a key role in that project.
Well, Professor Chostadovsky, I think we have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for your insights and into this situation, and you'll look forward to speaking to you again, I guess, when you get back to Canada. But thanks again for your analysis.
Bye for now.
We've been speaking with Professor Michel Chostadovsky, the award-winning author, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He spoke to us from Cebu in the Philippines. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. The 2018 Olympics in Pyeongchang have finally come to a close. While generous attention was paid to the United Korean Olympic team and the undiplomatic gestures of the U.S. vice president, there was significant underreporting by the major media of the disruption of South Korean society and the environment in the lead-up to and during the Games. The Global Research News Hour recently had a chance to interview someone well-versed in the more seamy side of the Games. So we are joined right now by Jules Boykoff. He is a professor of political science at Pacific University in Oregon and the author of three books on the Olympic Games, most recently Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. He's also a former professional soccer player who represented the U.S. Olympic team in international competition. Thank you so much for joining us, Professor Boykoff. I was wondering, now that the games are over, the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, a lot of controversy, but I guess I'm just wanting maybe to get your general overview, given that you're very familiar with the way these games typically play out, cynically and otherwise. What was your main take from this year's Olympics?
Well, I would say that the Pyeongchang 2018 Winter Games were a pretty clear reminder that the Olympics have become this humongous Janus-faced behemoth, where on one hand you have amazing athletes doing amazing things, on the other hand you've got these processes at play, economic and political, that often hurt the local host population. This year, what was perhaps memorable was something even outside of those two elements, which was the bringing together of North Korea and South Korea to participate behind a unification flag. At least during the opening ceremonies, when they marched in together, they did leave the closing ceremonies under separate flags. So that raised a lot of hope in the region that there might be peace talks and diplomacy moving forward. So that has to be seen as a plus. It's also a big question mark at this stage as well, because every time we've seen in recent Korean history where there's been some coming together between the North and South, there's often been a backlash where the North backs away, and we see sort of a falling backward in the process.
I was wondering we could discuss some of the issues, like, for example, the whole Mike Pence debacle, where he pretty much pretty much shunned the United Korean team, and some very sloppy diplomacy there. Do you see that backlash will permeate in a permanent way, or at least for a very long time, in terms of dealings with the West?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that Vice President Mike Pence in the United States kind of elephant stomped his way into the Olympics and really provided a bit of a PR nightmare for the United States, in the sense that he disrespected the Koreans who walked in under that unification flag I was mentioning by not standing up. Whereas everybody else was giving him an ovation, he sat there stone-faced and looking kind of grumpy, probably a little bit too close for his comfort to the sister of Kim Jong-un, who was sitting in the row behind him. Whether that's going to have any kind of long-term implications, I don't think so. I think what you're seeing in the region is the North and South are starting to talk a little bit more, and that's quite likely to make people like Mike Pence and his boss, President Donald Trump, a little bit nervous. They want to have a finger on the pulse of what's going on in the region, and they will. I mean, let's not forget another really important factor. Immediately upon the closure of the Paralympic Games, the United States and South Korea have planned joint military operations, and that's sure to rile the people in the North. Kim Jong-un will not be happy about that, and quite frankly, could bring us all the way back to square one, as if none of this had even happened in the first place. So I think we need to sort of think ahead with a little bit of caution and not get our hopes up too much. But I wouldn't overstate either what Mike Pence did. He was clumsy, he was embarrassing, but I don't think it's going to make major damage. The U.S. just has a lot of leverage in that geopolitical situation.
The games themselves, as the International Olympic Committee just relocates to a different city every couple of years, and there usually tends to be some very negative fallout for the host countries. I was wondering if you might just wish to just somehow succinctly give us like what the general trend is with all of these with each successive Olympics.
Sure. Well, each Olympics is slightly different in the sense that they happen in different places around the globe, and so they kind of come with their own geopolitical issues that are specific to that Olympics. But there are definitely some trends that we see if we study the Olympics through time. One of them certainly that's gotten a lot of attention recently is the elevated cost of the Olympic Games. Between the time when a city bids for the Olympics and they ultimately deliver them, costs tend to go up astronomically. We can just talk about nearly any Olympics. There was a study by Oxford University that looked at all the Olympics between 1960 and the present and found that there was huge cost overruns at every single Olympics for which there was reliable data. And so there's that. For starters, and there's more and more people that are waking up to that. Pyeongchang was no exception. It was supposed to cost somewhere between $6 and $7 billion during the bid stage. And upon delivery, it was really more like $13 billion. So there's that. I mean, I'd say a second element is that the Olympics tend to bring militarization to your city. When you host the Olympics, they become such a large event that they draw the attention of people who might wish to do harm to or raise the profile of their group by creating some kind of act of disruption or terrorism. And so you've seen the budgets for the Olympics go through the roofs, and local security forces basically using the opportunity to basically use the Olympics like their own private ATM machine, getting all the weapons, specialty weapons they would never be able to get during normal political times. In Pyeongchang, you saw all this biometrics that was secured for the Olympics. And that won't be boxed up and returned to sender. That'll be part of everyday policing in the Pyeongchang region moving forward. You know, a third trend is greenwashing, where the Olympics tends to say they're all green and environmentally minded, but in reality they do very little for the environment. In fact, the Pyeongchang Games may well be remembered as one of the most greenwashed games, in the sense that they sliced down, they clear-cutted a number of old-growth trees, you know, like 58,000 old growth trees, and cut down this ancient forest in order to make way for a ski run that was just used for a couple of weeks. And so incredible controversy around that. That was the home to a number of protected species, including the lynx and the flying squirrel. So that has happened before as well, you know, Rio de Janeiro just a couple of years ago and previous Olympics. So greenwashing is definitely a third trend. You know, the fourth one, I could go on, but a fourth trend is the big false promises that are lost at every time we see an Olympics. And this is going to, the promises that there's going to change the city and the region for the better. It's going to bring all sorts of jobs. And, you know, that just simply doesn't play out. And in fact, we saw in South Korea that many of the local ski rental organizations were forced to close down during the Olympics when the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, and the local organizers basically just took over the space. And so you saw a number of disgruntled ski rental operators who were actually losing money during the Olympics when they were told it was going to be this big heyday, payday for them. It was anything but that. So, you know, these are some of the trends that have made bidders and bid cities around the world quite nervous and less inclined to go for the Olympics in their town.
Was there any opportunities for people to help in, you know, doing some of the behind-the-scenes work, build the structures and so on and so forth? And I guess, you know, people had a chance to maybe volunteer.
Right. So, I mean, in terms of the construction contracts, I mean, that's a whole separate business where usually it's well-connected economic elites who make off with these really lucrative contracts to build the stadiums. But you're right. There is always a sort of army of unpaid volunteers who come in for the Olympics. In Pyeongchang, we saw 15,000 volunteers who came to participate and get into the Olympic spirit and to try to help the game pull off. I mean, I would just say a couple of things about it, though. One is that there were widespread reports that a number of these volunteers were disgruntled by the living conditions they found once they arrived in the region. There was also small portions of not-so-great food. They didn't get enough work breaks. In fact, about 2,000 of the 15,000 quit because it was so rough in terms of what their expectations were basically shattered, many of them, when they got to Pyeongchang. The second thing is, you know, with these volunteers, and I saw this when I lived in Rio de Janeiro in the lead-up to and then during the Olympic Games back in 2015 and 16, and, you know, a lot of the volunteers in Rio, and the same thing applies to Pyeongchang, come from relative privilege. I mean, you can't just quit your job or, you know, drop out of school and move across the country or from another country to be a volunteer at the Olympics unless you're a person of some means. And so basically it provides an opportunity for those who already are doing pretty well for themselves. So there's, in other words, there's a class bias ingrained in who becomes a volunteer. But, you know, the fact is, despite the reality that the International Olympic Committee has all sorts of money sloshing through its system, it does kind of rely on a backbone of unpaid volunteers at each and every Olympic Games.
So who then are the winners from these games? I mean, you have the athletes, but I'm talking about economically, like who attains either short-term or long-term benefits from these games?
Yeah. Well, at the top of the list has to be the International Olympic Committee, who has coffers of around $1 billion in reserves. And they get all the contracts for broadcasting. They have a lot of money flowing in terms of the corporate sponsorship. They have a very lucrative worldwide partnership program. So they're doing very well for themselves. And when the International Olympic Committee, which is basically about 100 people who are members, when the International Olympic Committee comes into your town for the Olympics, they get the five-star treatment. You know, they stay in the best hotels. They have incredibly high per diems that they can claim on top of the high living that they're doing there. And so, you know, they are definitely doing well out of this. Corporate sponsors tend to do well. There have been some sponsors that have pulled out recently of the Olympics, most notably perhaps McDonald's has just said no to the games and backed out. But there's others that do well, not just because they can sell their products and advertise exclusively like Visa and Coca-Cola in them, but also companies that are like Dow Chemical. They're not selling stuff directly to us per se, but they can hobnob and take clients there and treat them like royalty at the Olympics. Because let's face it, corporate sponsors are royalty at the Olympics. They get to drive in the special driving lanes that are set up to bring around athletes and medics so that they're not late to the events. Same with corporate sponsors. I mean, they just get treated like champs at every Olympics. So those are some of the winners, to be sure, and they come off at every single Olympic Games, no matter where they are. Each Olympics also has local winners in the sense that you have well-connected political and economic elites who make off with bundles of money from these contracts that I was mentioning before to build things. And, you know, the closer that these contracts come to the deadline, the more they can demand. So the prices tend to go up, and that accounts for some of the spike in cost that I was discussing a few minutes ago. So there are winners. It just doesn't happen to be the everyday people of the Olympic City, and it doesn't happen to be the people that are promised that they're going to win at the outset either.
Jules Boykoff, I really want to thank you for providing us with this overview of the Olympics as the dust settles on that the 2018 Games. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you, Michael. Take care.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Pacific University in Oregon and the author of three books on the Olympic Games, most recently Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. In the lead-up to the Olympic Games, there was a scenario playing out in Hawaii where citizens were being warned of an incoming ballistic missile. Intended or not, the consequence was a frightened population with a renewed sense of concern about the dangers posed by North Korea. Although the coincidence of this accident coinciding with the talks in Vancouver has certainly raised some skepticism among many people in the general public. To revisit that event and some of its fallout, we're joined by Dr. Leonard Horowitz and investigative journalist Sherry Kane, both based in Honolulu. They have both put together a 57-minute multimedia docu-commentary titled The Hawaii Deep State Nuclear Psyops, which posits that the January missile scares in Hawaii and Japan were not a consequence of human error, but rather served an elite agenda. Thank you for joining us, Leonard and Sherry.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for having us.
So, first of all, according to the final report from investigating officer retired Brigadier General Bruce Oliveira, the ballistic missile warning, which went out on media and on cell phones at 8:06 in the morning of January 13th, and the 38-minute delay in correcting that alert was a consequence of human error reinforced by insufficient management controls and poor computer software designs. Given what we know from the public record, what can you say to our listeners to assure them that the official story is wrong?
Well, you have to look at the Federal Emergency Management narrative and the investigation report, and you find that it was the midnight supervisor. There were two shifts, the midnight and the early morning 8 o'clock shift. And it was the midnight supervisor that had already left at about 8:03 in the morning. She was off duty. She phoned in to the PADCOM security system, and she actually changed the message. She actually changed the alert message to say that this was not a drill. And in doing so with her access device, it came across the system a couple minutes later, and the button pusher did the right thing. He actually saw it as a not drill. He got the message, and he was trained very well, and he pushed the correct buttons, which caused then the delay. Initially, the alert, which then was delayed for 38 minutes, which can only be explained by official malfeasance. Literally, there was an agenda. 38 minutes happens to be the exact time it takes for a ballistic missile to travel from North Korea to Los Angeles. So there's apparently enough evidence to give probable cause to believe that this was a scam and it was a social engineering ploy that made a lot of money for the security industry.
And I can tell you, I confronted General Miyagi personally on this, and the fact that about 2 or 3 days later, Japan got the same missile alert, only they responded in 3 minutes. And I asked him, how can this be an accident and happen in Japan as well? And I can tell you by his reaction, he actually resigned right after we had this meeting. But I can tell you that his reaction was somebody who had no clue about really what was going on. He was left in the dark, too, and so were the other people surrounding him. It was definitely above his pay grade in what happened there.
And I personally also spoke to Major General Joseph Logan, who was in command of the military, the Army National Guard of the state of Hawaii, who was responsible for the entire civil defense team. At the same meeting where Sherry confronted General Miyagi, I confronted General Logan, Major General Logan, and he was clueless. He was absolutely clueless about literally what was happening, the parties that were implicated, the multinational corporations and the investment bankers, literally the private equity investment bankers that made the money from the fright. The agenda made a lot of money for the security industry. Anyway, he was not given he was given information on a need-to-know basis only. That's what happens when you have compartmentalization within the security systems and the military. You're given information on a need-to-know basis only, and both General Miyagi and Major General Logan both were clueless.
Okay, now General Miyagi, he's the head of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency?
He was, yes.
Was.
He resigned.
Okay.
He resigned. Also, Major General Logan has now been replaced. They've had a complete change. And unfortunately, these people were ignorant. In our opinion, based on the evidence that we're looking at, they were kept in the dark. It was above their pay grade, as Sherry said, to have the insider intelligence. And it made a lot of money for the investors in, for example, AT&T, which was rolling out their special first alert system. A $40 billion investment, and that was one of the first clues that we got that angered us, was you had the governor of the state of Hawaii, Governor Iggy, come out and say, well, this just goes to show you that if we had been involved already and had been online with the first alert system of AT&T, well, then this would not have happened. So it was used as a publicity and advertising virtual stunt. And it frightened the hell out of all the people here. There was at least one death, if not more. The distress was extreme, and they literally made a lot of money doing it.
Okay,
Edward Snowden, the company, the national security contractor that he worked with, that actually
Booz Allen Hamilton,
that made a huge deal right before this happened. And we suspect they had something to do with this, because if anybody was going to be able to hack this system, it could have easily have been them.
But it was an individual. We learned through solid sources, including the button pusher's testimony, that it was the night security officer who, the supervisor, who actually had to go in with her access device and access the system. And It would have been okay had she just accessed the system. She had told the morning supervisor on his way out, he was actually supposed to be on the job. He didn't. He neglected his position. He neglected his post. He went out to get some lunch. And she told him as he was leaving to go to lunch that they're going to have a drill. She didn't communicate it clearly, and that would have been okay had she simply made a drill, but she didn't. She actually went through the text message alteration, which caused the alert.
And on top of that, you had the NBC reporter there 3 hours before the incident happened, down where this all happened, where the button pusher was. So there was definitely some suspicion about how he was there right before this incident happened with this false nuclear drill that sent everybody just we didn't know what to do. When we got that drill, we're like, okay, is there a missile coming? Because my cell phone says there is, and that's how everybody thought. I mean, we thought, well, where are we going to go? Where can you go when a missile's coming your way? There's really nothing we can do.
Leonard,
you
know, Sherry, I just wanted to ask, I mean, because you're already sort of touching on the another topic I was going to ask about, the motive, and you're suggesting that this is a big moneymaker for these the security firms and IT firms. And you know, I think most people have already suspected that something's fishy about this because of the coincidence that happened in Japan, the same time as this Vancouver group meeting at a time when there's a lot of tension. But I think most people a lot of people thought of it as just a pretext for continuing some kind of a military venture against North Korea. But you seem to be suggesting that this is mostly about corporations profiting off of that fear.
Michael, I think your analysis is right on. It's smack right on. The only thing that we're saying, we add and basically compound the evidence of the fact that the military industrialists that were in Vancouver, basically by the foreign minister's meeting to discuss what kind of security measures and force would be used against North Korea, the multinational corporations that drive the virtual war hawks surrounding President Trump, the deep state, essentially these people are running the private equity investment banks. And so when you look at who made the money, and you look at, for example, AT&T, or you look at Booz Allen Hamilton, the security firm that received $95 million contract just before this for the cybersecurity, you look at those firms and you see that commonly the common denominator is that you have BlackRock Investment Group, you have the Vanguard Group. Those are the common denominators. Those were the stockholders that made the most money from this fright, which drove both a military as well as diplomatic as well as commercial economic agenda.
And I do believe that North Korea is just pretty much represents the boogeyman. I mean, if these warmongers didn't have North Korea to blame, oh, the missile's going to come from there, they would have to create somebody else. They would have to make up somebody else who's doing it. And I do believe that North Korea is actually really behind China. I mean, China is the one that's really the threat more than North Korea. I think North Korea really works for China on a personal level. And so all of this stuff like, why would they send a missile to Hawaii that has so much money coming in from China to Honolulu, especially? Why would they even consider, why would he even consider sending a missile over here to really the people that are funding him in doing trade with him? I mean, to me, that doesn't seem...
No, it's illogical and it's unreasonable when you look at the financial aspects and the political aspects of what went down. It's completely unreasonable. And then on top of that, you have all the testimonies. You have the testimony of the button pusher. You have the Federal Emergency Management review of the whole circumstance. And that's why we put it together. And the video that we did, I think, and the articles that we've done on this matter, they're on revolutiontelevision.net is the video. I think people can sign up to get a free pass to view it on the healthyworldnews.com website. There's a password that you can get in for free with.
I just wanted one more point I wanted to get some clarification about that I think is very important. This idea that somehow the elites managed to hack in. It kind of reminds me of those election machines where someone could vote for John Kerry, but the result is George Bush. And it can't be verified. And I'm wondering if you say that you believe that these employees were actually doing, they were pressing the button or the choice for a test missile as opposed to real missile. Are we talking about a hack that would have allowed that kind of to get around what the intention of these employees were doing?
Well, the interesting thing is on some of the videos, we saw actually a sticky note on the side, which actually had the password to get into the system on. So why would they just have those passwords just open like that? It'd be so easy for anyone to be able to get that password. That's one thing. Another thing is they can easily do it remotely. So if somebody pushed the right button, they could program that button to do whatever they wanted to do.
See, now that's where we first thought. When we started to investigate, that's exactly where what you just said and where Sherry went was what we first thought, that there was some sort of a hack, that Booz Allen Hamilton was most implicated. But then it turned out that, no, it wasn't a cyber security breach. It was a human intentional change in the script of the alert system that had to have been placed at about 8:03 in the morning. It was done by the night supervisor. And so the fact that nobody's talking about the night supervisor is heavily implicating what we're saying as true, because silence, there is a U.S. Supreme Court famous judge named Judge Louis Brandeis. And Brandeis stated a number of times that silence is evidence most persuasive. That if you are silent about something such as this, you've got the whole mainstream media, you've got all of this fright, all of this money, and yet there's silence on the fact that the night watch person, the night supervisor, actually did this. What are we looking at? We're looking at a broad-based conspiracy. That's what I'm saying.
It wasn't reported
it's
in
silent.
Any media.
Michael, you're getting this intelligence. We put this out on revolutiontelevision.net. We put it out on waronwethepeople.com. And you're the first host of a radio show that's actually picked up the phone and called us for this interview. Now, that says a lot to me. It says that there's not real interest out there in the mainstream media to tell the truth about what's really happening here. So thank you, Michael, for being honest and brave. Yeah.